Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is the 11th of the third month, 2026. It is a Wednesday evening and the time is 3 minutes past the hour of nine. My name is the Matriarch. I am the creme de la creme, the ultimate drip, the cherry on top, the icing on the cake, the whole cake. And the table where the cake is chilling, and I'm definitely the tiles where the table, the cake, the icing, and the cherry on top are chilling. How about that? Ladies and gentlemen, my aim and objective is violence. My aim and objective is to talk about the things. Everything and anything under the sun is not beyond our table. Ladies and gentlemen, we are supposed to be addressing the elephant in the room because the elephant is too large of an animal for us to pretend it doesn't exist. So what happens now when the elephant is our mind? What happens when the elephant is our brain? What happens when the elephant is us? What happens when we are the elephant in our own rooms? Breaking free of your mind. Now, I'm a firm believer in the mind. I'm a firm believer in the heart, the spirit, the body, everything. I believe in everything. When it comes to human beings, I believe that everything is capable. I believe that everything is not capable. I believe that we as human beings, yeah. It's a Jedi situation out here. It's like a test upon a test upon a test upon a test upon a test. And I don't think we're gonna make it. I don't think we're actually gonna pass. Mara, I've got faith. I've got faith in us. Right? And the one thing that I have noticed is that many of us live in captivity. Many of us live in what will people say? Many of us live in what do I think that people will say about me. So it's not really what people would say. It's what you think people will say. So how do we break free from this prison? How do we break free from our own realities? How do we break free from being a prisoner in our own bodies and in our own minds? Breaking free of your mind involves cultivating mindfulness to observe rather than identify with negative thoughts and habitual limiting thoughts patterns. Limiting thought patterns. So habitual limiting thought patterns. Key strategies include practicing self-compassion. Now, self-compassion in itself is something that many of us, I think, or let me not put you in a boat where you don't belong, because maybe you are out there and you give yourself hella compassion. You are like the most compassionate person towards yourself, and you have no idea what I'm talking about because it is something that is unrelatable to you, right? But for me as a being, practicing self-compassion has been the hardest thing to do. I think it's because it's easier to be compassionate to other people because you put yourself in their shoes and then you understand why they feel the way they feel, why they do the things they do, why they are the way they are, why they move the way they move. And then you are compassionate towards them because you see their battles, you understand their battles, and their battles are what their battles are. And it's easy for us to be compassionate with other people because somewhere, somehow, we put ourselves in other people's shoes, right? Conversations in my shoes. And this is easy, but I find it extremely difficult. I find it extremely difficult as a person to practice self-compassion. I have no idea how to do it. Picture that. Like, I have no idea how to do it, but I can do it for you. I can listen to you, right? But I don't know how to listen to myself. Now watch me. So I must go and listen to the Eagle FM podcast on our app. Because if you guys don't have the app, then I don't know, Kunjani. I don't know what's happening. Yeah? But you guys must download the app. So I must go and be listening there to myself, and then I'll be like, aw, Elizabeth is so sad. It's like, it's cringe worthy, guys. It's cringe. It's like, so I know how to listen to you. But I don't know how to listen to myself in that aspect. I know how to give you a hug. I know how to motivate you. I know how to be there for you. But then how do you practice such compassion towards self. Because, with another person, you can touch them, you can hug them, you can allow them to be whatever they want to be in that moment, and you can allow them to unwind. But with self-compassion, it's practicing intentional kindness towards oneself. It's practicing intentional compassion towards oneself. It is being able to sympathize with yourself, being emotionally intelligent enough to understand that you, just like everybody else, is a human being. And that is a quest that I am still on, guys. I'm still in the Ramadulas of self-compassion, but I can't even say we're really trying because we're at step one, guys. Like, hey, I don't know. I don't know if we're really trying. I don't know, man. Like, I'm just out here and I'm trying. And regular meditation. Now, regular meditation depends on who you are and how you feel meditation is. Good evening.
Good evening, Elizabeth.
Yes, Tate Buana. How are you? Yes, dear. I saw that you guys spent 2 hours speaking Oshiwambo.
how are things, mommy?
Things are fixing, my dear. But we are trying. Yes, things are fixing. But we are trying. Aluta continue, Andishi.
Aluta continue,
huh? Eh, no.
I thank God for that.
Mm.
It's so encouraging.
Mm.
So for me now, the topic,
yeah.
I understand it's very important that you,
mm-hmm.
toward others and toward ourselves is important.
Yeah. But how do you practice that towards yourself?
Ourselves.
But how do you practice that towards yourself, Tate Buana? Because I know I can be compassionate with you. I can sympathize with you and I can be emotionally intelligent enough to understand you as a person, as a father, as an employee, as an employer, as a farmer. Yeah. I can understand you in all your elements. But how do you turn the tables around and understand yourself?
Yeah, I think it's just to also, maybe can you not use the same method?
I don't know. Give me an example now of when you were compassionate towards yourself.
Self-awareness and all this.
Give me an example of a time where you were compassionate towards yourself.
At least, okay.
One example.
To make sure also that you are not neglecting yourself in terms of finance, for example.
Hmm. Ah, yeah, those are just needs. We're talking about compassionate. Ohenda nji, ohenda no rukeno nji ope oya kweni.
Aya ndito na unega ndito rekwa mu.
Ngini ne.
Yendi na memena ndito ngomi to.
Ngini. Shasho ya kweni, oya tulire o motivational speech, eh? Toti ni maka inasha iningi kana kameme.
You help them with money.
But then we are talking about compassion, really being compassionate.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh.
Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. Oh, eh. And then also now really save myself.
Mm-hmm.
Then Andiko Kim Taki, I carry on go now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel at peace also, although temporary.
Sometimes. Because compassion is sympathy and concern.
Yeah, and I'm also concerned with my stomach, my needs.
That's just hunger, Tate Buana. I find it very difficult as a person to practice intentional self-compassion.
Yeah,
I think that I'm struggling with that one.
I think I'm also in the same situation.
Ne?
I'm telling you.
Shashino unkwenito mada totalilimpono o honge kere kemos. Anongwe wihe kere kenengwe mwenengini. Otin otine wana wanini makaina shainengi.
Maybe you know what I can think of now.
Yeah.
Maybe we are getting up with chai. Oh, the web is running already. We are getting up with chai. Please, I'm a person.
Mm.
I'll come out from this problem.
Mm.
You know, God will give me some courage.
Mm.
When you are somehow afraid again,
mm.
you become like motivating yourself and yeah. say, I'm not just give up, man.
Yeah.
So maybe issue of that area.
I think also when it comes to self-compassion, one of the things that are overlooked is not putting yourself in a bad situation. I think that's self-compassion.
I think so. I think so too.
When something has hurt you a number of times and then you decide that, you know what? I am not going to go and visit my brother anymore. Because my brother hurts my feelings. That means you have a concern with yourself. That means you are also sympathetic towards yourself. And then self-compassion would be you practicing to protect yourself and to protect your peace as well.
Yeah, you are correct, mommy.
Yeah.
That's why I say some of these emotional things or this kind of psychological issues is very complex for us to understand.
Mm.
Now that you mention all those things, I'm getting it.
I'm
understanding. And this is where we really neglect ourselves.
Mm.
And also we don't, to motivate ourselves and say no. Now that maybe you can also use some other example.
Mm-hmm. Just hold the line for me, Tate B.
Okay.
Cyber threats are no longer just an IT problem. They are a risk to our national security and the core of our economy. Join various leaders and industry stakeholders at the 3rd Namibia International Cybersecurity Conference and Exhibition, NICSC 2026, taking place from the 22nd to the 24th of April at Arabush Travelodge in Windhoek. Corporate early bird registrations close on the 31st of March. So register now at dstech.com.na. NICSC 2026, securing Africa's digital future.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch and Tate Bwana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that when it comes to showing sympathy and concern, right, I would say if it was sympathy, maybe that moment where you allow yourself to feel sorry for yourself because something bad really happened to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you allow yourself, right, to okudanai.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you allow yourself kucha oshimashino sha happening ane oshimoshinai. And even if I was advising my friend, I would allow my friend to cry because this is really bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Really? I was thinking also of that thing because sometimes, but usually, it is very difficult also.
Yeah.
Because you know that you are compassionate toward yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in case of, maybe crying is true.
Mm.
Because that one also release some pressure.
Yes.
And then you become more at peace again.
Mm.
If you have lost your peace and that joy. And I think that also motivates you to carry on and go about your day-to-day activity.
Mm.
And also maybe let's say now the academic issue.
Mm.
You are also now trying to, you know, to just say, even though I don't have money.
Mm.
But I can always, before I put myself so under stress, and then you can also try to restrict yourself from, you know, from having those kind of
expenses,
nightmare, and just to work like as if you are And everybody can say, ah, this person is, why is so down? Of course, you can be down. But, you know, sometimes you will not allow that kind of situation, that those conditions to overwhelm you that much. So I think it's a very complex topic, Mami. So I think you people who have been immersed in those psychological issues, so it's good that you are giving us those things so that we can...
Tete Buena, have you ever been feeling so bad, ne? Like, uvitenai, so badly. And then you go to town or you go and do your things. And then somebody does something kind for you. Like, just out of the blue, a stranger does something kind for you. Gaini manjano yone hai lili sa jenjo. And then somebody, it doesn't have to be somebody I know. It can just be a stranger that he, indiku falel.
Yes.
Oh.
You know, sometimes you feel like, exactly. Because you are actually 100% correct. Because when you are in that kind of situation, but then somebody just suddenly assisted you or whatever in that manner. You know, you feel like...
crying.
So what if a Samaritan has come and said, God... and when, even when you think about it, even when during your prayer now, when you think about those things, and then you start weeping. Start weeping. That's the tear of joy.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the program. Well, you know, the program really contributes a lot to us. So sometimes, I don't know, sometimes when you come in and things like that, and we feel at ease. And then that some of the burdens and things like that, and I know most of the time it's stress and you know this kind of thing. But when you get so released from this burden, you know. So thank you very much, Mami. God bless.
All right, God bless Tete Buana. Today we are reading, ne?
Yeah.
Today we are reading, so you must have a pen and a paper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we are going to read. Or you must lay comfortably so you can listen to the book.
Yeah, and I will just have to get a paper.
Yeah, and then you listen to the book.
Yeah, I get a book and a pen.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mami.
All right, Tete Buana. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hi. Welcome to Pulling Heart Strings. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are talking about breaking free of our minds, breaking free of the things that control our mind, breaking free of us, right? Breaking free of the prisons that we have made within our minds. Part of the prisons that we have built in our minds is lack of self-compassion, because many of us fail to be compassionate towards ourselves, and understandably so, because it is a very difficult activity to actually master, because we were taught be kind. But I don't remember any of my teachers in kindergarten, any of my teachers in primary school, any of my teachers in high school, any of my varsity lecturers, anybody saying, be kind to yourself. I was taught to be kind to others. You know, one of the first certificates that I got in my whole entire life was kindness and helpfulness. Kucha, I'm those things. I'm kind and I'm helpful. So, but in this kindness that we were taught, there was nothing about also be kind to yourself. And as a result, we are extremely kind people to others. And when we make mistakes and when we mess up, we turn around and we are the hardest on ourselves. We beat ourselves to a pulp, Chomi. We beat ourselves down. We condemn and crucify ourselves so bad, right? That our biggest enemies are ourselves. It's not even a stranger that's coming from somewhere. We are our own enemies. And the next one, right, in order for us to break free of the prison that we have created within our minds or within our hearts or within ourselves as people, is regular meditation. Now, this one is a tricky one. I think breaking free of ourselves and breaking free of our minds has been or will be the hardest thing any human being ever has to do. It takes time because you didn't automatically become the way you are. It is your culture. It is your religion. It is your ethnicity. It is your heritage. It is your lineage. It is your friends. It is your environment. It is your workplace. It is the living conditions. Everything that you have endured from birth till today plays a role. Plays a role in who you are. Whether you want to or not. Some people say that, yeah, but I come from a very abusive environment, but I'm not like that. But I would beg to differ. I would say that you are not abusive because you came from an abusive environment. Had you not come from an abusive environment, you probably would have been abusive or you would have not been abusive. But for now, now that these are your dynamics and this is your reality, we'll take it as such. We are all influenced by one thing or another. And part of the hard things also, so everything that involves self-preservation or working on self, right? I deem it to be very hard. I deem it to be very hard because I was never really taught to put myself at the center. I was never really taught to put myself at the front. I'm always the guy backstage making sure that everything on stage is going well. I'm the guy behind the lens shooting the movie. I am the guy that's writing the script. I am the guy that is behind the mic, not in front of the TV. I am the guy that makes things happen. I'm that person that puts others first. I consider you. I consider your emotions. I consider your state of mind. I consider who you are. And in that, somewhere, somehow, I never learned how to consider me. I never learned how to regulate me. I never learned how to be in the present with myself. But I can sort out your entire life with one conversation. But I struggle with it myself. And one of my struggles is meditation. Like, what the hiba is that? You must sit or you must lay down and you must just breathe in, breathe out, and then you let your imagination run with you and you meditate. And it doesn't have to be like that because we meditate differently as well. And being a human being is such a complex thing. It's so complicated to be a human being because it's not one glove fits all. It's not one size fits all. It's all of us are individuals and all of us adapt to things differently. So my idea of meditation might be subtle music and I might be sitting up straight and I might be within my element. Another person's idea of meditation is most probably taking a run with loud music where they can allow themselves to be free and to think. Another person's form of meditation is playing loud music and taking long distance drives. Another person's form of meditation is swimming. Another person's form of meditation is practicing mindfulness to enhance their presence, to be in the present. Another person's meditation is most probably sitting outside in the breeze and letting Mother Nature just flow through them. You understand? And it's not one size fits all. So I think that for me, part of my meditation process is honestly just radio. Radio brings me joy, brings me peace. It brings me a calmness. It brings me, it gives me that anchor. And the next thing on how to break free from our own minds, right? Because our minds are double-edged swords. They cut on the good side, they cut on the bad side as well. Our mind is the same person. Our mind is the same element that can tell us jump. And our mind is also the same element that can tell us don't jump. That's how twisted this thing is. Somewhere, somehow, you don't know if you can trust it or you can't trust it. But it's yours. It's yours. It's supposed to be in survival mode. It's supposed to be in freedom mode. It's supposed to be in relax mode. It's supposed to be in all these modes, right? And then sometimes, right, because of all the ordeals that you have been through life, your mind builds a little prison cell and keeps you there under the notion that it's keeping you safe. But it's actually doing more harm than good. So part of it is reducing digital distractions, because I think we are so caught up in the digital world and it takes a lot from us. You know why I fancy radio? I fancy radio because radio requires your ears and your mind. And within listening to radio, right, you broaden the horizon when it comes to your imagination. It allows you to create. That's why I'm a fan of radio, because radio allows you to create without visual manipulation. Because if I play you a music video on TV, then you will never truly hear the words. And that's why we sing wrong words, because we learned the songs from TV. But with radio, you have no other option but to listen. So reduce digital distractions and challenge yourself, your self-limiting beliefs.
Titanium, the perfect fit between platinum and silver, complementing our existing benefit options. We always offer a comprehensive healthcare experience. NHP, the premier member-centric medical aid fund. Visit NHP today at nhp.com.na. NHP, we're about you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. So, we're talking about breaking free from our minds. And we're talking about breaking free from the negative elements of our mind. Those ones, the ones that are dangerous, the ones that are detrimental to us. And it is. So, challenging self-limiting beliefs to achieve emotional freedom. So, self-challenging beliefs. Self-limiting beliefs, actually. Sorry. Self-limiting. So, self-limiting is you saying that you are incapable of doing something. You really want it, but you can't do it, apparently. We say apparently because most of us don't even try. And most of us don't even leave the comfort of our lives to actually go out there and try. Many of us have given up opportunities to go anyway, to go job hunting, because it's out of our comfort zones. Many of us have given up opportunities to do anything that is outside of what we think is what we're supposed to be doing. For example, money is not written that this is money from a fed cook lady. This is money from a plumber guy. This is money from a radio presenter. This is money from a journalist. This is money from... Money is not written, but yet many of us sit in our homes with our degrees, telling ourselves that we will not stoop lower and become burdens and liabilities on other people because we believe that we are above everything else that people are doing as a source of living. And you find someone that puts themselves through school while they are security guards. And then you look at these two, right? And one you would say This is pure entitlement, right? This is just spoiled. This is just bad. But also understanding them, because we're also practicing compassion, right? Also understanding them is that they feel that it will demotivate them to keep looking for a job, because they will get comfortable in selling fat cakes and seeing that $100 a day. So they would rather starve for now until they get their big break. But what happens when the big break doesn't come? What happens if you are not meant to be an economist? You are meant to know economics. What if your destiny is to understand logistics, is not actually to go and work within the logistics sphere? What if you are not meant to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist? You're meant to be a radio presenter that talks about the elements of psychology. What if? And that's the twisted part, because that's the twisted part. Because you don't actually know what your future is supposed to look like. You have an idea of what you want it to look like. But you have no idea. And that is why people say that we're fighting so hard for a life that might just end tomorrow. Right? Because we don't know when the last day is. Because if we knew, there would be chaos. We'd be buying more time. Extra time from others. You understand? So, these limiting beliefs that we might have, they are the ones that are causing us to not have emotional freedom. And I know that most of them are very difficult to actually dissect and to comprehend, because they often involve the world around us. Part of the battle that children that are adopted battle with is, why didn't my parents want me? As an adult now, there are so many things that I'm starting to comprehend about my parent that I could only ever understand in my life after I had become a parent, that I had my own household. I understand it now. And that is why people say things like kula umone, dengwa ulungame. Because some things you cannot be told. Some things you have to experience yourself. And that is why sometimes we must keep quiet when conversations come up that we don't actually have any idea. Because your maker will test you. That time that you said, me, I would never, tomorrow, SJ, I would never pull the machine on my mom, even if she's in ICU for 20 years. I would never. Tomorrow, your mother is in ICU for 10 years. And you owe the hospital 200 million or 2 million. Let's go at 2 million. You knew you sell fat cakes. 10 years. What will happen? Do you think that there are people out there that want to pull the plug on people? No. It's the circumstances of life. But if you haven't walked a mile in someone's shoes, in the most cases, I think it's best for us to say, in my opinion, compassionately speaking, or keeping quiet. Because some of us, ne? Ons prat ons mond verby. So ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're doing the reading corner. And we're doing the 7 levels of consciousness. And ladies and gentlemen, the reason that we are reading is because many of us don't have opportunities. Many of us don't have platforms. Many of us don't even know where to find these self-help books. Because I think we need all the courage we can get along this way. Kutsashi, whoa. Shimoshiju, shimoshadigu para. Right. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we as Eagle Media House and the Matriarch do not claim any ownership of the content we are about to play. It is strictly for learning purposes on our segment that we call the Reading Corner that comes in on our Wednesdays because we no longer have open conversations. We no longer have Can We Fix It Wednesdays. We have the Reading Corner. With every year comes a new dynamic of growth.
We live under the illusion that we inhabit a single world, a solid reality shared by all. But the truth is that there are infinite worlds, infinite realities, coexisting in the same space and time. The difference between a world of suffering and one of wholeness, between a life of struggle and one of flow, does not lie in external circumstances. It lies in the level of consciousness from which life is perceived. Imagine that consciousness is a grand seven-story building. Most of humanity is born, lives and dies in the basements and on the first levels, on the floors of survival. From there, the view is limited. The walls seem solid, fear is the air you breathe, and you believe that life is a constant battle against scarcity. From those lower floors, it is impossible to see the landscapes of infinite possibility that are seen from the terraces of the upper levels. You have felt the longing to ascend. You have intuited in your most lucid moments that there must be something more, a higher way of being. That longing is proof that you are ready to receive the hidden map of your own mind. This knowledge has been called forbidden, not because it is evil, but because it gives you back your sovereignty. It reveals that you are not trapped on your current level. It shows you the stairs. This audiobook is that map. Together we will travel through the seven levels of consciousness, from the dark basement of the victim to the luminous penthouse of the Creator. You will not learn to change the world. You will learn to change the floor from which you observe it. And by changing your level of consciousness, the world you observe will have no choice but to change with you. The stairs have always been there, waiting. Chapter 1, The First Level, Victim Consciousness. Ascension begins at the lowest point. Before we can climb to the luminous penthouses of power and creation, we must first have the courage to turn on a light in the basement where we have been living. We must know, with brutal honesty, where we stand. For the great majority of humanity, the starting point, the default level of consciousness, is the dark, damp, and often comfortable basement of the building of being. This is the first level, victim consciousness. The fundamental characteristic of this level is an inverted perception of reality. From this basement, life is seen as something that happens to us. We are a passive object, a small boat at the mercy of an ocean of uncontrollable external forces. Other people, the economy, the government, genetics, fate, bad luck. Life is the subject. We are the object. Victim consciousness is not a moral defect. It is a survival strategy. It is the human ego's default program, designed to protect us from the immense and often terrifying responsibility of our own power. As long as the cause of our suffering is out there, we are safe from the difficult task of looking inward. Living on this level is to inhabit an invisible prison, a prison whose walls, although made of the ethereal matter of our own thoughts, feel as solid as granite. And this prison is supported by three fundamental pillars. The first pillar, the blame game, the projection of power. The first and most solid pillar of victim consciousness is the blame game. The mechanism is simple. The mind, to avoid the pain of assuming its own responsibility, projects the cause of its unhappiness outward. There is always an other who is to blame. If there is scarcity in our life, the fault lies with the government, the economy, our unfair boss, or our parents, who didn't give us a better education. If our relationships are a failure, the fault lies with our ex-partners, who were toxic, narcissistic, or incapable of loving. If our health is deficient, the fault lies with bad genetics, pollution, or an inadequate health system. The victim's mind is a master at constructing narratives in which it always plays the role of the wronged innocent. In its inner movie, it is the righteous hero fighting against a cruel and corrupt world. This story, although painful, provides the ego with a very seductive reward, moral justification. By blaming another, we feel morally superior. Our unhappiness becomes a badge, proof of our goodness in a bad world. The fundamental problem with blame is that it is an act of bleeding power. Every time we blame something or someone external, we are declaring, the cause of my experience is outside of me. And if the cause is outside, then the solution must also be. We become prisoners who wait for the jailer, whom they hate, to be kind enough to open the cell door. We surrender our sovereignty. We hand over the keys to our own lives to the very forces we complain about. The initiate in forbidden knowledge learns to see blame as a compass. When he feels the impulse to blame, he knows that this is an unmistakable sign that he is operating from the first level of consciousness. He knows that this is an invitation to withdraw the projection, to stop looking at the other, and to ask himself, what belief in me has attracted this experience? How have I, with my own state of being, contributed to the creation of this situation? This is the first and most difficult step to getting out of the basement. The second pillar, the language of powerlessness, complaint as prayer. The second pillar that supports the prison is language. Victim consciousness has its own dialect, its own way of speaking and thinking. And the most important word in that dialect is complaint. Complaint is not a simple description of a negative reality. It is a vibrational ritual. It is an affirmation. It is a prayer for lack. Every time we complain, we are using our creative power, the power of the word, to reinforce and solidify the reality we say we don't want. I'm so tired. A command for the body to generate more fatigue. This is impossible. A decree that closes the door to any creative solution. I'll never find anyone. A prophecy that the subconscious will take care of fulfilling. Complaining is also a form of social bonding in the basement of consciousness. People in the victim state often gather to form what are known as complaint communities. They get together to talk about how bad the world is, how unfair their bosses are, how difficult their lives are. In these conversations, they compete to see who has suffered the most, who is the biggest victim. This exchange, although it seems negative, provides a sense of connection and validation. I'm not alone in my misery. It is a bond based on shared wounds, not on shared strength. At a neurological level, chronic complaining is an act of self-destructive neuroplasticity. Every time we complain, we reinforce the neural circuits of pessimism and powerlessness. We literally build a brain that is an expert at detecting problems, finding faults, and ignoring solutions. We become Olympic athletes of negativity. The master learns to be a guardian of his own word. He understands that every phrase he utters is a seed, and he refuses to continue planting the weeds of complaint in the garden of his mind. This does not mean that he practices toxic positivity or denies problems. It means that he chooses to use his language to describe the problem from a place of power. We have a challenge to solve, instead of from a place of powerlessness. We are doomed. The third pillar, the emotion of powerlessness, apathy and resentment. Finally, the atmosphere, the emotional climate of the victim's basement, is dominated by two twin emotions, apathy and resentment. Apathy is the emotion of surrender. It is the feeling that nothing I do matters. It is the learned helplessness that arises after repeated attempts to change external reality by force, without understanding the law of reflection. Apathy is the natural consequence of believing that power is outside of you. If you believe you have no control, the most logical response is to do nothing. This often manifests as depression, a lack of vital energy, the feeling of living a life in black and white. Resentment is the other side of the coin. It is the energy of anger that has not been expressed or transmuted. It is the bitterness that builds up when we feel that the world owes us something and refuses to pay us. It is the poison that results from the victim's story. As we have seen, resentment is a biochemical state of chronic stress that corrodes our body from within. But why would anyone choose to live in such a toxic emotional climate? Because, incredible as it may seem, the victim state has a secret reward. It offers a secondary benefit that the ego finds irresistible. The benefit is that it absolves you of the terrifying responsibility of your own power. Being the creator of your own life is a liberating idea, but it is also an immense burden. It means there are no excuses. It means that the quality of your life depends entirely on the quality of your own consciousness. For the ego, which fears failure above all else, this responsibility is terrifying. The victim role offers the perfect alibi. If the world is to blame, then I don't have to do the difficult inner work of changing my beliefs, healing my wounds, disciplining my thoughts. I can stay in my comfort zone, even if it's a miserable comfort zone, and justify my inaction by blaming external forces. Victim consciousness is not a weakness. It is a hiding place. It is the place where the soul hides from the immense power and immense responsibility of its own divinity. Living in the basement of victim consciousness may seem like a lifelong sentence, an immutable reality. The walls of blame and complaint seem solid as granite, but even in the darkest cell, sometimes, a ray of light filters through a crack. These cracks are moments of cognitive dissonance. They are instants when the victim's narrative fails to explain reality in a satisfying way. Perhaps we see someone who started from much worse circumstances than ours and has managed to create a life of success and joy. This fact is an anomaly that the victim's program cannot compute. If the world is to blame, how is it that this person, with worse cards, has won the game? Perhaps we experience an unexpected act of kindness or generosity from someone we expected nothing from. This event contradicts the belief that no one supports me, or people can't be trusted. Or perhaps, and this is the most common, the suffering becomes so unbearable that it breaks its own container. The pain of staying in the cell finally becomes greater than the fear of the unknown that lies outside of it. This is the moment of hitting rock bottom. It is not a tragedy, it is an act of grace. It is the soul shouting with a thunderous clarity, "There has to be another way." The moment that question arises, the first crack in the prison wall has appeared, and through that crack the light of a new possibility enters. The possibility that maybe, just maybe, the power is not out there. The first step of ascent, the art of radical responsibility. The first step to getting out of the basement of victim consciousness is not a complicated technique or a mystical ritual. It is a simple but terrifying choice. It is the choice to take 100% responsibility for our life experience. Let's pause here, because this is the most important decision a human being can make, and it is crucial that we understand what radical responsibility is not and what it is. It is not blame. Taking responsibility does not mean blaming yourself for the terrible things that may have happened to you. It does not mean that you deserved it, or that it was your fault that you were betrayed, or that you were in an accident. It is not control. It does not mean that you have control over all the events in the universe. You do not control the weather, the economy, or other people's decisions. Radical responsibility, in its essence, is the recognition of your ability to respond. It is the act of reclaiming your sovereign power to choose your response, your perception, and your meaning in the face of any circumstance that life presents to you. The prisoner in the victim state believes that his happiness depends on the jailer, the external world changing. The individual who takes the first step toward freedom realizes that his happiness depends, solely and exclusively, on his own inner choice. This change is immediately reflected in the type of questions we ask ourselves. The victim asks, "Why is this happening to me?" It is a question that seeks blame and reinforces powerlessness. The creator who awakens asks, "For what reason is this happening to me? What is this situation here to teach me?" It is a question that seeks the lesson and reclaims power. The victim declares, "My partner can't talk to me like that." It is a declaration that tries to control the other. The creator asks, "Why have I attracted this experience? What boundary do I need to learn to set? What belief in me about deservingness is being reflected here?" It is a question that seeks the inner cause. Taking radical responsibility is the act of ceasing to be the effect and starting to be the cause. It is the moment you stop being the pawn on the chessboard and you realize that you are the player. The workshop of the freed prisoner, integrated practices. The initiate who decides to leave the basement does not wait for the jailer to open the door. He begins to forge his own key. His workshop is his journal, and his first tool is the pen of responsibility. One of the most powerful practices to catalyze this change is the responsibility inventory. The initiate makes a list of all his main complaints, of all the areas of his life where he feels like a victim. For each complaint about a person or an external circumstance, he forces himself, with a brave honesty, to find and write down at least one way that he has contributed to creating or allowing that situation. If the complaint is, "My boss doesn't value me," the inquiry might reveal, "Maybe I contributed by not clearly communicating my achievements, by not setting boundaries on my workload, or by not believing in my own worth myself." If the complaint is my partner doesn't listen to me, the inquiry might reveal, "Maybe I contributed by not listening to her, by interrupting her, or by communicating from a place of complaint rather than from a clear and vulnerable request." The goal of this exercise is not to find blame, but to find power. The moment you identify your contribution, you have found the lever. You have found the only point in the entire system over which you have 100% control, yourself. The second practice of the initiate is a vigilance of his own language. He commits to a fast from blame and complaint. Every time the old victim's voice arises in his mind or his mouth, he observes it without judgment. He recognizes it. Ah, there's the old pattern. And then, deliberately, he replaces it with a question of power. Instead of saying, "It's impossible to get a raise with this economy," he stops and asks himself, "What unique value could I bring that would make a raise inevitable, regardless of the economy?" Instead of complaining about his lack of energy, he asks himself, "What small action can I take right now to generate 1% more energy?" This linguistic change is an act of conscious neuroplasticity. You are weakening the highway of powerlessness and starting to blaze the trail of possibility. Getting out of the basement of victim consciousness is the most difficult and most important act of the entire spiritual journey. It is the true birth of the individual. It is the moment you stop being a passive reflection of your programming and reclaim your power as the light that projects the image. It's not an easy path. The ego will fight with all its might to keep you in the familiar story of the victim. The old programming will call to you with its siren song of comfort and non-responsibility. Your friends in the basement may feel betrayed by your decision to seek the light, but once you have seen the light through the crack in the wall, you cannot go back to total darkness. Once you have tasted the intoxicating sensation of your own power, the tasteless food of blame can no longer satisfy you. Chapter 2. The second level, the consciousness of struggle. It is crucial to understand that this level is not a mistake. It is a necessary and monumental evolution. It is the first great awakening. At this level, the fundamental perception of reality is reversed. Life ceases to be something that happens to you and becomes something you can make happen. You stop being the effect and become the cause. You stop being the victim and put on the warrior's armor. The warrior archetype is the soul of this level of consciousness. It is a stage of immense power and great achievements in the external world. It is the level from which empires are built, Olympic medals are won, and the peaks of corporations are reached. It is the consciousness that drives humanity to overcome its limits and conquer what seemed impossible. The new worldview, reality as a battlefield. From the warrior's perspective, the world is no longer a place of random chaos and injustice. It is transformed into a battlefield, a great strategic game full of challenges and opportunities. Obstacles are no longer seen as punishments of fate, but as enemies to be defeated. Goals are no longer impossible dreams, but territories to be conquered. This new perception is incredibly empowering. The powerlessness of the victim is replaced by a sense of control. The warrior knows that, through discipline and effort, he can impose his will on matter and shape his destiny. The main tool, willpower. If the victim's tool was complaint, the warrior's tool is willpower. At this level, the muscle of discipline is discovered and cultivated. The warrior learns to master his impulses, to overcome laziness, and to push beyond discomfort. "No pain, no gain" becomes his mantra. He learns to get up early, even if his body asks for rest. He learns to make the sales call, even if he feels the fear of rejection. He learns to say no to instant gratification so he can say yes to his long-term goals. The warrior's life is a testament to the power of self-discipline. It is the demonstration that the conscious mind can, through sustained effort, take control of the automatic reactions of the body and emotions. The emotional climate, ambition and frustration. The warrior's emotional landscape is intense and charged with energy. The dominant emotion that drives him is ambition. It is the fire of the desire to grow, to achieve, to win, to prove himself. It is a proactive energy that pulls him out of passivity and launches him into the world. The negative emotion that defines this level is no longer the victim's self-pity, but frustration and anger. When the world does not bend to his will, when an obstacle stands in his way, the warrior does not lament. He gets angry. He feels a surge of aggressive energy. This anger for the warrior is a fuel. He uses it to redouble his efforts, to attack the problem with more force, to prove that he is more powerful than the resistance he encounters. The fruits of the second level. We should not underestimate the achievements of this consciousness. It is the level of the hero in our culture. People who operate from this state are often the pillars of society. They are the entrepreneurs who create jobs, the athletes who inspire us, the leaders who build nations. They learn to master the material world. They achieve the wealth, status, and recognition that the victim could only dream of. From the perspective of the basement, the second floor seems like a palace. The shift from victim consciousness to struggle consciousness is, without a doubt, one of the most important evolutionary leaps a human being can make. It is the act of reclaiming one's power. The shadow of the warrior, the golden prison. And yet, despite all his achievements, despite his immense power, the consciousness of struggle is not the final destination. It is a stage, not the goal. Because this level, although it may seem like a palace from below, is in reality a prison. A golden prison, perhaps, but a prison nonetheless. The shadow of the warrior, his fundamental limitation, is that his worldview remains dualistic. He still lives in a universe of me against the world. His peace depends on victory. He can only relax when he has won the battle, when he has reached the goal. But since life is an endless series of challenges, his peace is always temporary, fragile, followed by the anxiety of the next battle. He does not know unconditional peace. His worth depends on his achievements. His identity is completely fused with his successes and failures. If he wins, he is a winner. If he loses, he is a loser. His self-esteem is not intrinsic. It is a reflection of his external performance. He lives in a state of constant pressure to prove his worth. His mode of operation is struggle. He believes that the only way to create is through effort, tension, and control. He does not know the power of surrender, of collaboration with the universe, of effortless flow. His life is a perpetual war, and a war, no matter how glorious, is always exhausting. The warrior has escaped the powerlessness of the basement, but he has become trapped on the battlefield of the second floor. He has learned to control his actions, but he has not learned to control the source from which his actions are born, his own state of consciousness. The energy cost of perpetual war. The warrior has built a golden palace on the foundations of the basement. He has power. He has agency. He has achievements. But the foundations of his kingdom are shaking because perpetual war, no matter how victorious, always has a cost. An energetic, biological, and spiritual cost. Living in the consciousness of struggle is living in a state of chronic activation of the sympathetic nervous system. It is the fight or flight mode turned into a lifestyle. The warrior's inner orchestra is a constant fanfare of adrenaline and cortisol. This state, designed by nature for short bursts of survival when it becomes the norm, begins to devour the body and soul from within. The physical cost, chronic exhaustion or burnout, is the sacred disease of the warrior. His body, being constantly on alert, never enters the rest and repair mode. His immune system weakens, his digestion suffers, his sleep is shallow. He lives in a paradox. He is wired by stress but profoundly tired. The mental cost. Creativity and long-term vision require access to the prefrontal cortex, the master brain. But chronic stress diverts energy from this area and concentrates it in the amygdala, the primitive brain. As a result, the warrior's thinking becomes rigid, reactive, and short-term. He loses the ability to see the big picture. He becomes an expert at winning battles, but often he loses the war. The emotional cost. To be able to endure the harshness of the battlefield, the warrior often builds an emotional armor. He disconnects from his vulnerability, his tenderness, his capacity to feel deeply. He becomes efficient, but dry. His heart, though strong, is closed. The empty victory, the awakening of the warrior. The great tragedy of the warrior is that often, after decades of struggle and achievement, he reaches the top of the mountain he set out to conquer, and upon looking around, discovers that he still feels a deep emptiness. He has won the world, but he has lost the connection to his own soul. He realizes that the peace he longed for was not to be found on the mountaintop, but in the ability to enjoy the journey, something he never allowed himself. It is in this moment of existential crisis, in this empty victory, that the warrior is presented with a new choice. He can redouble his efforts, look for an even higher mountain to conquer, believing that the next victory will finally give him peace. This is the path of endless suffering. Or he can do something much braver than any battle he has ever fought. He can lay down his arms. He can sit on the top of his mountain, look at his dented armor, feel his exhaustion, and ask himself the question that changes everything. What if there is another way? This is the awakening of the warrior, the moment when consciousness realizes that the true enemy was never out there. The real battle was always internal, and the true victory is not conquering the world. It is making peace with oneself. The practice of the wise warrior, the search for a third way. The awakening of the warrior is not an act of surrender in the victim's sense. It is a strategic surrender. It is the recognition that brute force has a limit and that a superior power exists in intelligence and alignment. The initiate who is ready to transcend the second level does not need to learn a new doing technique. He needs to learn the art of seeing in a different way. His practice becomes contemplative. The wise warrior begins by performing an audit of the struggle. He takes his journal, not to list his goals and battle plans, but to audit his effort. He asks himself, in what areas of my life am I applying a disproportionate force? Where do I feel like I'm rowing against the current instead of flowing with it? What battles am I fighting out of habit, out of pride, or out of the need to be right, that no longer serve my highest purpose? This act of honest self-observation reveals the points where his energy is being wasted in useless struggles. Once the struggle is identified, the wise warrior does not surrender the path of the victim, nor does he redouble his effort, his own default path. He looks for a third way. He begins to ask himself questions from a higher level of consciousness. Instead of, how can I defeat this obstacle, he asks, what if this obstacle is not an enemy to defeat, but a door that invites me to find a smarter path, a path I had not seen? Instead of, how can I force myself to be more disciplined, he asks, what if the solution is not in doing more, but in being in a different way? What inner state, if I cultivated it, would make the right action flow effortlessly? Instead of, how can I control this outcome, he dares to ask, what would happen if, for a single day, I completely let go of the need to control and trusted in a higher intelligence? These questions are revolutionary. They mark the shift from a paradigm of control to a paradigm of collaboration. The warrior begins to intuit that perhaps the universe is not an adversary, but a potential partner. The consciousness of struggle is a noble, essential, and powerful stage. It is the forging of willpower, discipline, and personal power. Without it, nothing lasting can be built. It is the fire that transforms the raw ore of potential into the steel of capability. No one can skip this level. But it is not the home, it is the training ground. The final awakening of the warrior occurs at the moment he realizes that the true victory is not the one won over the world. It is the one won over the need to struggle itself. It is the discovery that the greatest power is not the ability to impose one's will, but the wisdom to align it with the will of the universe. Chapter 3, The Third Level, Achiever Consciousness. This is the level of consciousness that our modern civilization idolizes. It is the pinnacle of success, as defined by the world. If the victim is the pawn, and the warrior is the rook, the achiever is the master player who moves all the pieces on the board. The leap from the second to the third level is a leap from force to intelligence, from reaction to deliberate creation. Consciousness stops seeing the world as a battlefield to be conquered by force, and begins to see it as a system that can be understood, managed and optimized to produce specific results. The architecture of achievement, the keys to the third level. The achiever is an architect. His power lies in his ability to design a future and then build it brick by brick with astonishing precision and effectiveness. This operational state is supported by three fundamental pillars. One, the power of the goal, the future as a destination. The warrior fought by instinct. The achiever acts with purpose. The fundamental tool of the third level is the goal. Achiever consciousness understands a fundamental principle of the mind. The subconscious is a remote-controlled mechanism. Like a heat-seeking missile, it needs a clear target to be able to mobilize its immense resources. Without a target, energy is dispersed. With a clear target, energy is concentrated into a laser beam. At this level, people learn the art and science of setting goals. They learn to be specific, to measure their progress, to set deadlines. They transform the vague dreams of the victim and the brute ambitions of the warrior into detailed action plans. This is the level where many first discover the laws of manifestation, but they often use them from a purely mechanical perspective. They use affirmations and visualizations not as an act of aligning their being, but as mental programming tools to achieve a result. The what, the external goal, remains more important than the who, the person they become in the process. 2. The currency of time and productivity. Optimizing doing. If the goal is the destination, the vehicle to get there is productivity. The achiever is a master of time and energy management. He understands that these are his most valuable resources and becomes obsessed with optimizing their use. This is the world of self-help books on efficiency. The achiever learns to prioritize, using principles like the Eisenhower Matrix or the Pareto Principle, to eliminate distractions, to create systems, and to leverage his effort. Unlike the warrior, who believes that the only solution is to work harder, the achiever seeks to work smarter. His life becomes an engineering project. Every hour of the day is scheduled. Every action has a purpose. Every result is measured. This discipline allows him to reach levels of productivity and material achievements that are incomprehensible to the lower levels. 3. The engine of external validation. The self as an achievement. Here we get to the core. The fuel that powers the achiever's engine. Why this incessant need to achieve? Because at the third level of consciousness, identity is completely fused with performance. The worth of the self is measured by the success of the doing. The achiever has overcome the powerlessness of the victim and the reactivity of the warrior, but he continues to operate from a fundamental wound, the belief that he is not enough on his own. His tireless pursuit of achievement is, deep down, a search for validation. Every goal achieved, every trophy won, every number added to his bank account is an attempt to silence the inner voice of inadequacy. The scorecard of his life is completely external. The title on the business card, the size of the house, the likes on social media, the admiration in the eyes of others. He lives for applause. The golden fruits of achievement. We should not demonize this level. Achiever consciousness is the driving force behind much of our civilization's progress. It is the energy that has built our cities, driven scientific advances, and created companies that employ millions of people. The people who inhabit this state are the winners of our society. They are the CEOs, the elite athletes, the renowned artists, the influential politicians. They enjoy a level of material wealth, power, and freedom of choice that is the envy of many. They have learned to play the game of the material world and have won. They have built a magnificent palace on the third floor, far from the dark basement of the victim, the shadow of the achiever, the golden cage. And yet, despite all the external brilliance, the third level is not the final destination, because the palace that the achiever has built is in reality a golden cage. It is a prison so comfortable, so beautifully decorated, and so admired by others, that its inhabitant often doesn't realize he is a prisoner. The shadow of achiever consciousness is subtle, but deeply corrosive. The first bar of the cage is the when-then trap. The achiever lives perpetually in the future. His inner peace is always conditioned on the next achievement. I'll be happy when I get the promotion. I'll relax when I hit the sales target. I'll enjoy life when I retire. But when he reaches the goal, the feeling of satisfaction is incredibly fleeting. a brief moment of relief before the anxiety for the next goal sets in. He falls into the hedonic treadmill, needing increasingly larger achievements to feel the same emotion. Happiness is never here and now, it is always on the next summit. The second bar of the cage is the fear of stillness. The achiever is an action addict. His doer identity depends on being in constant motion. Rest is not seen as a source of renewal, but as a sign of laziness, a waste of time, a threat to his status. Silence terrifies him, because in the silence he might have to face the emptiness that his achievements are trying to hide. This fear of stillness is the recipe for the most sophisticated form of exhaustion, soul burnout. And the third and thickest bar is the loss of the self. The achiever has identified so completely with his actions and his roles that he has forgotten his true essence. He is no longer a human being. He is a CEO, a doctor, an athlete. If you take away his title, his function, his list of achievements, he often feels that there is nothing left. He has sacrificed the totality of his being on the altar of his function. He has lost the ability to enjoy the simple, joyful experience of existing, without any agenda, without any goals. The achiever has won the world, but often at the cost of losing himself. The cage is comfortable, but the soul which longs for infinite expansion begins to feel claustrophobic. And it is at this point, at the peak of worldly success where the deepest crisis often occurs, the call to the next level of consciousness. The achiever has built a magnificent golden cage, admired by all who remain on the lower levels. From the outside his life seems perfect, but the soul cannot be caged forever, no matter how golden the bars are. Sooner or later, the deepest part of our being, the one that longs for authenticity and freedom, begins to beat against the walls of the prison. This awakening is often catalyzed by one of three great life events. The first is the crisis of empty success. It is the moment when the achiever, after years of Herculean effort, finally reaches the great goal he set for himself, the one he believed would give him lasting happiness. He gets the promotion, sells the company, wins the championship, and for a brief moment he feels euphoria. But then, a few days or weeks later, a feeling of emptiness begins to creep in. He realizes, with a chilling horror, that the promised happiness has not arrived. The inner landscape remains the same, and he is faced with the most terrifying question for the ego. If this wasn't the answer, what is? The second catalyst is the collapse from exhaustion. The achiever's engine, fueled by the cortisol and adrenaline of constant ambition, finally burns out. The body, which has been ignored and treated as a mere tool, says, enough. This often manifests as a health crisis, a heart attack, an autoimmune disease, a chronic exhaustion, burnout, so deep that it prevents him from getting out of bed. Life, through the wisdom of the body, forces him to stop by force, since he refused to do so by choice. And the third catalyst is an uncontrollable event, an external force that shatters the achiever's illusion of control. It can be an economic crisis that takes his business, a betrayal from a trusted partner, or the loss of a loved one, an event that, no matter how much he tries, how much he plans, or how hard he works, he cannot fix. This event forces him to confront his own fragility and to seek a source of security that does not depend on external circumstances. When one of these events occurs, the cracks in the golden cage become a fracture. And through that fracture, the achiever, for the first time, glimpses the possibility of a different kind of freedom. The great reframe. From doing to being. The awakening of the achiever is the beginning of a profound process of reframing. It is the act of changing his life's operating system. The first and most important change is to move from an identity based on doing to one based on being. The initiate who is ready to transcend the third level embarks on the difficult but liberating task of unlinking his worth from his achievements. He begins a practice of self-observation, where he learns to see his successes and failures not as a verdict on his identity, but as fleeting experiences that his consciousness is witnessing. The second change is to move from an external scorecard to an internal one. The achiever stops measuring the success of his day by the number of tasks completed or by the approval of others. He begins to use an inner compass. His new questions, the ones that define a good day, become, was I authentic today? Did I act with integrity? Did I feel peace? Did I express love? Was I present? He realizes that the quality of his inner state is the only true measure of success. And the third change is to transform goals from destinations into vehicles. Goals are no longer the place where happiness resides. They become vehicles for the growth and expression of the self. The goal is no longer to sell the company for 10 million. The goal is to enjoy the creative process of building something of value, and if the result is 10 million, fantastic. Joy is shifted from the destination to the journey. The practice of the awakened achiever. The initiate who finds himself in this transition does not need to learn new productivity techniques. He needs practices of inner reorientation. His main practice is the why audit. He takes his list of goals and for each one asks himself the alchemical question, what is the true motivation behind this goal? Am I pursuing this to prove my worth to others, to fill an inner void? Or am I pursuing this because it is an authentic expression of my soul, because the process itself fills me with joy? If the answer is the former, he doesn't necessarily abandon the goal, but he consciously reframes it, looking for a way to align it with a deeper purpose of service or growth. In addition, the awakened achiever begins to set a new kind of goals, goals of being. Along with his doing goals, launch the product, close the deal, he sets being goals. My goal for this project is to practice patience in the midst of chaos. My goal for this conversation is to listen with total empathy. He realizes that achieving the goal of being is, in fact, the true triumph, regardless of the external outcome. Achiever consciousness is the summit of what the ego, as a separate entity, can build in the world. It is a stage of immense power, a demonstration of the incredible capacity of the human mind to shape matter through will and discipline. But true mastery is not building the most beautiful golden cage. It is realizing that the cage door has always been open. The final awakening of the achiever occurs at the moment he lets go of the need for external validation and realizes that the only approval that truly matters is his own. It is the moment when his ambition is transmuted into aspiration. He no longer seeks achievements to feel whole. He seeks to express the wholeness he has discovered within himself.
Chapter 4, The Fourth Level, The Consciousness of Intention. The achiever, standing on the summit of his mountain of achievements, contemplates the emptiness of his victory. He has won the world's game, but feels he has lost the connection to his own soul. In that sacred crisis, in that divine dissatisfaction, he makes the most important pivot of all. He stops looking outward, seeking the next trophy. And for the first time, he turns his gaze inward, seeking meaning. He leaves the boardroom and enters the temple. This is the great turning point in the journey of consciousness. It is the crossing of the equator, the passage from the hemisphere of survival to the hemisphere of conscious creation. It is the moment we stop being an ego that tries to conquer the world and start being a soul that seeks to express itself in it. Welcome to the fourth level, the consciousness of intention. This level represents a paradigm shift so fundamental that it is, in essence, a second birth. It is the moment the red pill is taken. It is the awakening to the truth that the lower levels could only intuit. That our inner world is not just a factor in our life. It is the cause of our life. In the first three levels, although the individual's power grows, from the powerlessness of the victim to the strength of the warrior and the strategy of the achiever, the fundamental premise remains the same. We live in an external world that is solid and real, and our job is to react to it, fight against it, or manipulate it as effectively as possible. At the fourth level, this premise crumbles. The revelation of the law of reflection occurs. The recognition that the external world is a mirror, a projection of our inner state. And with this revelation, the game changes completely. It is no longer about getting things from the world. It is about emanating a quality of being from within ourselves. The question stops being, what can I get, and becomes, who do I choose to be? From goal to intention, a change in language. The language of the third level was that of the goal. A goal is an external objective, a destination on the map of the material world that the ego wishes to reach in order to, at last, feel validated and happy. The language of the fourth level is that of intention. An intention is radically different. It is not an external destination. It is a quality of being that the soul chooses to express in the present moment. A goal is, I want to earn $1 million. An intention is, I choose to be a channel of abundance and value and to live in a state of financial freedom. A goal is, I want to find a partner. An intention is, I choose to be an embodiment of self-love and wholeness, and to attract a relationship that is a reflection of that inner harmony. Do you see the difference? The goal is conditional and in the future. The intention is unconditional and anchored in the present. The goal seeks happiness in the result. The intention finds happiness in the process. The achiever lives for the goal. The conscious creator lives from the intention. The architecture of a master intention. An intention, to have creative power, must be built with a precise architecture. It is composed of three fundamental elements: clarity, emotion, and faith. 1. The clarity component. The what? An intention must be crystal clear. The universe does not respond to vague signals. An intention like, I want to be happy, is useless, because it does not define what happiness is for you. The initiate at the fourth level takes the time, in the stillness of contemplation, to distill the longing of his soul into a clear and concise declaration. Through writing, through meditation, he asks himself, what quality of being, if I fully embodied it, would transform my life experience? This clarity is not a process of willpower. It is a process of listening. It is quieting the mind enough to be able to hear the whisper of one's own soul. 2. The emotion component, the why. A third level goal is often driven by the emotions of the ego, the fear of scarcity, the need for approval, the desire to outperform others. It is a low vibration fuel that, although it can generate results, always leads to exhaustion. A fourth level intention is driven by the emotions of the soul. The why behind the intention must be an expansive emotion, love, joy, creativity, service, growth. The initiate examines his intention and asks himself, why do I want this? And he keeps asking until he arrives at the highest root emotion. I want to build this business. Why? To have financial freedom. Why do I want financial freedom? To not have to worry about money. This is an ego motivation based on fear. The initiate goes deeper. And what would I do if I didn't have to worry? I would dedicate myself to creating innovative solutions that help people. And why do I want to do that? Because the act of creating and serving fills me with a profound sense of joy and purpose. There it is. The true intention is not the business. It is being a channel for joy and purpose. When you align your intention with an emotion of the soul, you connect it to an inexhaustible source of energy. The faith component, the how. This is the quantum leap that differentiates the achiever from the creator. The achiever, third level, obsesses over the how. He creates detailed action plans and clings to them rigidly, trying to control every variable. His security resides in his plan. The creator, fourth level, understands that the how is not his job. It is the job of the infinite intelligence of the universe. His job is to define the what, clarity, and the why, emotion, with absolute conviction, and then to let go of the how with radical faith. This surrender is not passivity. It is an act of supreme power. It is the recognition that the conscious mind, with its limited vision, cannot conceive of the miraculous and synchronistic paths that universal intelligence can orchestrate. It is the difference between trying to navigate the ocean with a small paper map and trusting the cosmic satellite GPS. By letting go of the need to control the how, you create the space for magic to happen. The reflection of intention. The birth of synchronicity. When a person begins to operate from this fourth level of consciousness, the mirror of reality begins to reflect a new and magical quality. Events stop seeming random. The world starts to speak. Synchronicities appear. Synchronicity, a term coined by the psychologist Carl Jung, is a meaningful coincidence. It is the moment when an event in the external world aligns perfectly and seemingly miraculously with your inner state. You're thinking of an old friend, and at that instant the phone rings and it's them. You need the solution to a problem, and you open a book to a random page that contains the exact answer. You set the intention to find a mentor, and the next day you are seated next to the perfect person on a plane. Synchronicity is the language through which the universe confirms to you that it has received your intention and that it is conspiring in your favor. For the consciousness of the lower levels, these events are simple coincidences. For the initiate at the fourth level, they are proof that the law works. They are the traffic signs on the map of his soul, indicating that he is heading in the right direction. Living in the consciousness of intention is beginning to live in a constant and magical dialogue with reality. The great transition from doer to creator. Understanding the architecture of intention is one thing. Living from it, in a world that still idolizes the goal and achievement, is true mastery. It represents the fundamental transition from the doer to the creator. The doer, who operates from the third level, uses force and willpower. His energy is a push. He tries to impose his plan on reality. His motto is, make things happen. He takes pride in his effort and his struggle. His security lies in control, in having a detailed action plan for every step of the way. The creator, who operates from the fourth level, uses alignment and flow. His energy is a pull, a magnetism. He does not impose his plan. He sets an intention and allows reality to organize itself around him. His motto is, allow things to happen. His security lies not in controlling the how, but in the certainty of the what and the why. This change requires a profound reorientation of our source of power. The doer trusts his personal will, the strength of his own ego. The creator learns to trust a higher will, the infinite intelligence of the universe. He understands that his job is to align his small will with the great will. It is the recognition that his deepest desires are not whims of the ego, but whispers of the universe, which indicate the direction of his own unique expression. The creator's practice does not focus on effort, but on the purification of his intention. The doer is driven by the need to prove his worth. His achievements are an attempt to fill an inner void. The creator is driven by the longing to express his worth. His creations are an overflow of a wholeness he already feels within himself. The former is an energy of contraction and need. The latter is an energy of expansion and generosity. And the universe, the great mirror, reflects each one with perfect fidelity. The workshop of the awakened creator, integrated practices. The initiate at the fourth level transforms his daily practices. They are no longer tools to get something from the world, but to align with the truth of his own being. One of the most fundamental practices is that of the intentionality journal. The initiate no longer uses his journal to make to-do lists, but to write declarations of being. Every morning, instead of the doer's question, "What do I have to do today?" he asks the creator's question, "Who do I choose to be today?" The answer is not a role, but a quality. Today I choose to be an embodiment of peace. Today my intention is to be a channel of creativity. Today I choose to see the perfection in every person I meet. He writes this intention, and then he dedicates a few minutes to feeling it in his body, to visualizing what a day lived from that quality would be like. He is not planning his actions. He is setting his state of being, knowing that the right actions will flow naturally from that state. To purify his desires and ensure they are born from the soul and not the ego, the master practices the distillation of the why. He takes a goal that his mind has formulated, and like an alchemist who distills a substance to find its essence, he repeatedly asks himself, why? I want a raise. Why? To have more security. Why do I want security? To be able to relax and stop worrying. Why do I want to relax? To be able to enjoy my life and my family more. Why do I want to enjoy? Because it is a feeling of joy and peace. The master has found the gold. The true intention was not the money, it was peace and joy, and then, he reframes his practice. Instead of obsessing over money, he focuses on directly cultivating the state of peace and joy in his present, knowing that from that state he will attract the circumstances, including money, that correspond to it. Finally, the conscious creator knows that the universe is speaking to him. To learn its language, He keeps a log of synchronicities. The initiate dedicates a section of his journal to recording the meaningful coincidences. He notes the synchronistic event, the unexpected call, the random phrase overheard, the book that falls open to a page, and most importantly, he notes the inner state or question he had in his mind just before it occurred. Over time, this record becomes a personalized map of the dialogue between his intention and the universe's response. His faith stops being a belief and becomes a knowledge based on experience. He realizes without a doubt that he is not alone, that he is in a constant dance with an intelligent and responsive partner. The consciousness of intention is the great portal. It is the moment you stop being a robot programmed by the past or a slave to the goals of the future. It is the moment you reclaim your power in the only place it exists, the now.
Chapter 5. The fifth level, the consciousness of flow. To understand the profound transformation this level represents, let's imagine life as a great and powerful river. This river is the current of universal intelligence, the flow of life that moves, with an immutable purpose, toward the ocean of wholeness. On the first level, the victim is drowning in the river. He feels dragged by currents he doesn't understand, battered against the rocks of chance. His experience is one of terror and helplessness. On the second level, the warrior decides to fight. He gets into a small boat and rows with all his might against the current, trying to impose his own direction. His experience is one of heroic effort, but it is exhausting and ultimately futile. On the third level, the achiever builds a motorboat. He uses strategy and technology to sail the river, often in a straight line, believing he has mastered nature. He spends an immense amount of fuel, and although he reaches many destinations, he rarely feels the true peace of the river. On the fourth level, that of intention, the traveler finally turns off the motor. He has set his destination and now looks at the river with a new respect, beginning to trust its current. On the fifth level, the traveler does something radical. He lets go of the oars, he gets rid of the motor. He stands up in his boat in a state of calm and balance and learns to use a single subtle instrument, a small rudder. This rudder is his intuition. He no longer tries to force his way, but uses the small and delicate touches of his inner guide to navigate the powerful current of the river, allowing the immense force of life itself to carry him effortlessly and with perfect grace toward his destination. This is the state of flow. The anatomy of surrender, the power of letting go. The key word at this level of consciousness is surrender. Our mind, trained in the lower levels, equates surrender with defeat, passivity, and failure. But the surrender of the fifth level is not the passive surrender of the victim who gives up. It is an active and conscious surrender. It is the highest form of action, the Taoist principle of Wu Wei, often translated as effortless action or active non-action. What does this mean? It means you stop being the source of action and become the channel of action. It is not passivity. Surrender is not sitting on the riverbank and waiting for your dreams to float by. It's getting in the boat, being awake, attentive, and with your hand on the rudder. It is radical trust. Surrender is born from the deep and ingrained recognition that the river of life is intelligent and benevolent. It is the end of the ego's arrogance, which believes it is a separate entity that must control and plan every aspect of existence. It is the humility of recognizing that we are part of an immensely greater intelligence, and that by aligning with its flow, we access a power and a wisdom that our small logical mind could never conceive. It is the end of resistance. All human suffering, without exception, is born from resistance to what is. When we resist the present moment, when we argue with reality, we create friction, a tension, that manifests as stress, anxiety, and pain. The master of flow does not resist the present moment. He accepts it completely, not with resignation, but with the wisdom of knowing that every moment, even the most challenging, is a necessary stretch of the river that is carrying him to his destination. This radical acceptance of what is dissolves suffering and allows him to see with crystalline clarity the next inspired move. The feeling of flow. The psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi dedicated his life to studying this state, which he called flow experience. He described it as a state of total immersion in an activity, where the sense of self vanishes, time is distorted, and action and consciousness merge. It is the experience of the athlete in the zone, of the artist who channels a masterpiece, of the programmer who solves a complex problem in a state of joyful concentration. At the fifth level of consciousness, flow ceases to be an exceptional experience that happens by accident during a specific activity. It becomes the fundamental quality of life itself. You live in a state of serene confidence. Anxiety about the future dissolves because you trust that the river will take you where you need to go. Regret for the past vanishes because you understand that every bend in the river was a necessary part of the journey. Life ceases to be a series of problems to be solved and becomes an adventure to be experienced. The language of the river, intuition and synchronicity as the norm. How does flow speak to us? How do we know where to steer our subtle rudder? At the fifth level, intuition and synchronicity, which were magical glimpses at the fourth level, become the everyday language. Intuition as the current. Intuition is no longer an occasional hunch. It becomes the constant feeling of the current beneath the boat. It is a bodily knowing. You feel in your body which decision is expansive with the current and which is contractive against the current. You stop making decisions based solely on the logical mind's analysis of pros and cons and start navigating based on the wisdom of your inner compass. Synchronicity is the signs on the bank. Meaningful coincidences stop being surprising and become the norm. They are the signs on the riverbank that confirm you are going in the right direction. The book that falls open, the person who appears with the answer you needed, the opportunity that arises from nowhere. All are seen as part of the intelligent orchestration of the flow. Living in the consciousness of flow is inhabiting a universe that is no longer mute and mechanical, but alive, intelligent, and communicative. It is a constant dialogue between your soul and the soul of the world. The Great Paradox of Control. We have defined the state of flow as a surrender to the intelligent current of life, but for the mind trained in struggle and achievement, this is the most terrifying idea of all. Letting go of control feels like a death. The ego, whose identity is based on its ability to make things happen, sees surrender as a failure, an abdication of its power. Here we find the great paradox of control. The initiate at the fifth level discovers that the attempt to control life is what makes him lose all control. When we try to force outcomes, when we resist the tides of rhythm, when we fight against circumstances, we create immense friction. We get exhausted, stressed, and reactive. In our desperate attempt to control the river, we fall out of the boat and are carried away by it. True sovereignty, true control, is born from surrender. It is born from the recognition that we do not control the wind, but we can adjust our sails. It is born from the humility of admitting that our small logical mind cannot grasp the immense complexity of cosmic orchestration. True power is not forcing the river to follow our path. True power is becoming such a master navigator that we can use the river's own force to carry us to our destination, often by much more beautiful and efficient routes than we had planned. It is a shift from a power over life paradigm to a power with life paradigm. The workshop of the river master, integrated practices. The initiate who wishes to inhabit the consciousness of flow does not achieve it by accident. He cultivates it through a subtle and persistent inner practice. His workshop is no longer the boardroom of planning, but the silent deck of his own boat. The first practice is morning surrender. The master no longer begins his day with a detailed battle plan, with a rigid to-do list he tries to impose on the day. He begins instead with an act of alignment. In his morning meditation, his prayer is no longer one of petition, but of availability. His mantra is a variation of this. Universal intelligence that flows through all things. Today I surrender to your wisdom. Use me as a channel for your purpose. Show me the path of flow. I am open and willing to follow your guidance. May my will and yours be one. This act of morning consecration changes the energy of the entire day. It is no longer a day of struggle, but of co-creation. The second practice is using the body compass. To know if he is rowing against the current or flowing with it, the master uses the infallible wisdom of his bodily sensations. The practice is that of the expansive feeling. Faced with a decision, an opportunity, or a path to follow, The initiate does not just analyze it with his mind. He takes a moment to feel it in his body. He asks himself, how does the idea of taking this action feel in my body? Does it feel light, open, spacious, expansive? Do I feel a flowing energy of enthusiasm toward it? That is the unmistakable signal of flow. Or on the contrary, does it feel heavy, contractive, forced? Do I feel a knot in my stomach, a tension in my shoulders? That is the signal of resistance. The master learns through practice to trust the wisdom of his body over the often deceptive arguments of his ego. The third and perhaps most important of the practices is the art of the inspired no. To live in flow is not to become a passive leaf that says yes to everything life presents. In fact, it is the opposite. It is the art of saying no to almost everything, so you can say a powerful and resounding yes to the few things that are truly aligned with the course of your river. The master of flow is a jealous guardian of his energy. He knows that every time he says yes to an opportunity that feels heavy or forced, he is spending his energy rowing in a tributary that does not lead to his destination. Therefore, he uses his body compass to filter the countless requests and opportunities that are presented to him. He learns to say a calm, guilt-free no to the good opportunities, to keep his energy and space available for the great opportunities, those that flow will present to him, and that will feel like an absolute yes in his entire being. The consciousness of flow is the dissolution of the war between the self and the universe. It is the discovery that you are not a solitary navigator fighting against a hostile ocean, but a conscious expression of the current itself. Life ceases to be a series of problems to be solved and becomes a dance of which you are the protagonist. Chapter 6. The sixth level, the consciousness of unity. To enter this territory, we must first dismantle the most fundamental illusion of all, the root belief on which our entire civilization and all our suffering have been built. The illusion of separation. From the moment we are born, we are taught to define ourselves by our boundaries. This is my body and that is yours. I am here and the world is out there. This is my family, and that is yours. Our language, our science, and our psychology are built on the premise that we are egos encapsulated in skin, as the philosopher Alan Watts said. Isolated consciousnesses, navigating as solitary monads through a universe that is fundamentally alien to us. From this perception of separation, all fears are born. The fear of loneliness, the fear of death, the fear of scarcity, the fear of the other. Conflict, competition, and the feeling of being an insignificant fragment in a vast and indifferent cosmos are born. The great revelation of the sixth level of consciousness is that this separation is an illusion. An incredibly convincing, perceptual illusion, but an illusion nonetheless. The forbidden truth is that at the most fundamental level of reality, separation does not exist. Everything in the universe is intimately, inextricably, and eternally interconnected. You are not a drop in the ocean. You are the entire ocean, experiencing itself in the focal point of a drop. The scientific echoes of unity. This idea, which for millennia was the exclusive domain of mystics and sages, today finds astonishing echoes in the discoveries of cutting-edge science. Cosmology tells us the story of our origin. Approximately 13.8 billion years ago, everything we know, every galaxy, every star, every planet, every atom in your body was concentrated in a single point of infinite density and energy. The Big Bang was not an explosion in space, it was the expansion of space itself from that point of primordial unity. This means that every particle of your being shares a common origin with the farthest star. You are, in the most literal sense of the word, stardust. You are made of the same matter as the cosmos. Separation is an illusion of time and space. Biology reveals that we are not isolated entities, but walking ecosystems. Our body contains billions of microorganisms, our microbiota, without which we could not digest food or produce certain neurotransmitters. We are in a constant symbiosis with the world around us. The air you exhale, full of carbon dioxide, is the breath that gives life to plants. The oxygen that plants release is the breath that gives life to you. There is no real boundary between you and the atmosphere. You are a temporary knot in the infinite network of the biosphere. Quantum physics offers us the most disconcerting and direct proof. The phenomenon of quantum entanglement, described by Einstein as spooky action at a distance, demonstrates that two particles that were once connected remain mysteriously linked, no matter the distance that separates them. If you measure a property of one particle, the corresponding property of the other particle is determined instantly, even if it is on the other side of the universe. This violates our classical understanding of space and time, and points to a deeper truth, that at a fundamental level, the entire universe is a single, interconnected system. Science, in its own way, is beginning to draw the outline of the truth that mystics have always known. Unity is not a poetic idea, it is the fundamental architecture of reality. The Three Awakenings to Unity. For the human being, this understanding does not usually arrive as an intellectual theory, but as a series of awakenings, of direct experiences that dissolve the boundaries of the self. One, unity with nature. The first awakening is often the most accessible. It occurs in those moments of deep connection with the natural world, when you are breathless at the majesty of a mountain range, or you sit in silence by the sea and feel your breath synchronize with the rhythm of the waves. In those instants, the ego's chatter stops. The feeling of being a separate I that observes nature dissolves. And for a moment, there is only being. You feel the solidity of the mountain in your own bones. You feel the vastness of the ocean in your own consciousness. You are no longer in nature. You realize that you are nature. To unity with humanity. This is the awakening of true compassion. In the lower levels, our relationship with others is based on duality, friend, enemy, us, them, pleasure, threat. At the sixth level, you begin to look into the eyes of another person, even someone with whom you are in conflict, and to recognize beyond the mask of their personality the same spark of consciousness that burns within you. You realize that the consciousness that looks through your eyes is the same one that looks through theirs. Their stories, their beliefs, their wounds may be different, but the essence, the silent witness who experiences that life, is identical to yours. From this perception, judgment becomes impossible. How could you hate another if at their deepest level they are you in a different form? Irritation is transformed into compassion. Conflict becomes an opportunity for recognition. This is the true meaning of the greeting Namaste. The divinity in me bows to the divinity in you. You understand on a visceral level that hurting another is literally a form of self-injury. 3. Unity with the Source. This is the mystical awakening, the peak experience. It is the final and total dissolution of the feeling of a separate self. It is the moment when the drop of water, after its long journey, falls back into the ocean and realizes that it was never separate from it. In this state, there is no longer a you who experiences the universe. There is only the universe experiencing itself. It is the state of I am, pure consciousness, without attributes. It is the end of all searching, because you realize that you are what you have always been looking for. It is the recognition that you are not a creation of God, you are an expression of God. This experience can be fleeting, a glimpse of eternity. But once it has been lived, even for a single instant, it changes you forever. The belief in separation is revealed as a cosmic joke. And even if you return to inhabit your personal identity, you now do so with a new lightness, with the silent certainty that your true self is as vast as the cosmos. This is the vision that awaits you at the sixth level, the dissolution of loneliness and the birth of universal connection. The shadow of unity, the spiritual ego. You have glimpsed the truth of unity. You have felt in your heart that you are not a wave but the ocean. And this realization, although peaceful, is also the most radical of all, because it is a death sentence for the self you thought you were. To integrate this truth, you must cross the most feared and most transformative valley of all. But even at this high level of consciousness, the ego, in its infinite cunning, finds a final and subtle trap to ensure its survival. It is the trap of the spiritual ego. The spiritual ego is the part of us that takes the experience of unity and turns it into a badge, a trophy, a new and improved identity. It is the voice that whispers, "Now I get it. I am more conscious than others. I have reached a level that others cannot understand." This is the most dangerous veil of all because it is woven with light itself. The spiritual ego can lead to a form of subtle arrogance, a condescension toward those who are still trapped in the lower levels of consciousness. It can create an attachment to the experience. The seeker becomes addicted to states of ecstasy and unity, and judges his progress based on the frequency of these peak experiences, rather than on the quality of his presence in daily life. And in its most toxic form, it can lead to spiritual bypassing. It is the use of the absolute truth that everything is one to avoid dealing with the relative problems of human life. It is the person who justifies their bad behavior by saying, "It doesn't matter, everything is an illusion," or who ignores the suffering of others with the phrase, "Everything is perfect just the way it is." The true sign of having integrated the consciousness of unity is not the ability to have mystical experiences, but the increase in humility, compassion, and silent service. It is not a declaration of how much you know, but the recognition of how little you know. It is the dissolution of personal importance in the vast mystery of being. The workshop of the mystic, cultivating the consciousness of unity. The initiate at the sixth level does not seek to achieve unity. He practices the art of noticing the unity that already exists in every moment. His work is not to build, but to dissolve boundaries. One of the most fundamental practices is the meditation of dissolving boundaries. The mystic, in his stillness, follows the journey of his own breath. He follows the inhalation, recognizing that he is taking the outside, the air that moments before was in a tree, and turning it into his inside. And he follows the exhalation, realizing that he is giving his inside to become outside again. In the simple and constant dance of the breath, he experiences, moment by moment, the non-existence of a real boundary between his being and the world. Then he expands this consciousness. He sits with his back against a tree and practices the I am the tree meditation. He feels his own roots sinking into the same earth that nourishes the tree. He feels his spine as solid and still as the trunk. He feels his arms as the branches. And he realizes that the tree and he are two different expressions of the same life, of the same upward impulse that seeks the light. The master knows that compassion is not a feeling that is forced, but a perception that is cultivated. It is the natural result of seeing the world through the lens of unity. To train this lens, he practices the just like me exercise. When he encounters a person who generates irritation or judgment in him, instead of being dragged by that reaction, he pauses. And in the silence of his mind, he repeats a series of recognitions. Just like me, this person seeks happiness. Just like me, this person has known suffering and pain. Just like me, this person is doing the best they can with the level of consciousness they have right now. This simple act of recognition dissolves the illusion of the other as an enemy. It breaks the spell of judgment and opens the heart to the space of compassion, where the healing of relationships becomes not only possible, but inevitable. The consciousness of unity is the great homecoming. It is the end of loneliness. It is the discovery that love is not something that is given or received, but the very fabric from which everything is made. It is the peace that arises from knowing that you are not an isolated and fragile part of the universe, but the entire universe, experiencing itself. Chapter 7, The Seventh Level, The Consciousness of Being, I Am. What is this I that observes the universe? What is the nature of the consciousness itself that has been witnessing this entire journey? To answer this question, we must take the final step. A step that is not a movement forward, but a dissolution into the center. A journey that is not one of ascent, but of return to the origin. Welcome to the seventh and final level, the level that is at once the foundation of all the others and their culmination. Welcome to the consciousness of being. Throughout our entire journey, we have focused on the content of our consciousness, our thoughts, our emotions, our beliefs, our perceptions. We have learned to observe them, to cleanse them, to transform them. But now, we are going to do something radical. We are going to withdraw our attention from the content and place it on the container. We are going to explore the nature of consciousness itself. This is the journey of self-inquiry, the sacred question that the sages of all traditions have asked, who am I? Deconstructing the false I. To discover what we are, we must first relentlessly dismantle everything we are not. We have spent our lives identifying with a series of labels, of garments, believing they were our skin. The seventh level is the act of undressing completely. Are we our body? The answer seems obvious, but think about it. You say my body in the same way you say my car or my house. There is an I that owns and is aware of the body. The body is constantly changing. It ages, gets sick, heals. But the consciousness that observes it, the I that experiences it, remains constant. Therefore, we cannot be the body. We are the consciousness that inhabits and is aware of the body. Are we our thoughts? This is the most common identification. We believe we are the voice in our head. But if you can observe your thoughts, if you can witness how they arise and disappear, then, logically, you cannot be them. The observer is always distinct from the observed. Thoughts are clouds crossing the sky of your mind. You are not the clouds, you are the sky. Are we our emotions? We say, I am angry or I am happy, fusing our identity with the emotion of the moment. But emotion is a fleeting wave of energy. Yesterday's anger is gone. Last week's joy is a memory. Emotions are like the weather passing through the sky. They change constantly. But the I that is aware of both anger and joy remains. You are not the weather. You are the space in which the weather occurs. Are we our roles and our story? We identify with our roles. I am a mother. I am an engineer. I am Spanish. We identify with our personal history, with our achievements and our failures. But these are just characters we play in the great play of life. They are garments we put on and take off. The consciousness that played the role of the child 30 years ago is the same consciousness that is playing the role of the adult today. The roles change. The consciousness that plays them is immutable. When we perform this deconstruction, when we deny being everything that is observable and changing, what is left? At first, the logical mind may panic. It seems we are heading toward a void, toward nothingness, and in a sense we are. But it is not a void of annihilation. It is a fertile void. It is the silence from which all music is born. What remains when you strip away all the labels is pure consciousness, the simple, silent, and luminous feeling of being. It is the presence of the I am before you add anything to it. Not I am this or I am that. Simply I am. The nature of the I am, this is the seventh level. It is the recognition, the direct experience of your true nature as pure consciousness. And this state has several unmistakable qualities. It is formless and eternal. Pure consciousness has no form, no size, no age, no location. It was not born when your body was born, and it will not die when your body dies. It is the timeless and eternal space in which the entire universe, with all its time and space, appears and disappears. It is immutable. Your body ages. Your thoughts change every second. Your emotions fluctuate. Your roles evolve. But the consciousness that is a witness to all these changes has never changed. The consciousness that looked through your 5-year-old eyes, amazed by the world, is the exact same consciousness that is looking through your eyes now, reading these words. It is the only constant in your life. It is the immutable screen on which the changing movie of your existence is projected. Its nature is peace. The inherent nature of pure consciousness, when it is not identified with the drama of thoughts and emotions, is a deep and unshakable peace. It is the silence that lies beneath all the noise. It is not a peace you must achieve. It is the peace you discover has always been there when you stop creating conflict. It is the source of creation, and here we come to the final secret. This pure consciousness, this I am, is not a simple passive witness. It is the very substance of reality. It is the universal mind we spoke of in the first chapter. It is the quantum field of infinite potentiality. It is the light of the projector. It is the creative power of the universe, experiencing itself through your individual focal point. When you identify with the wave, your personality, your ego, you feel small, separate, and at the mercy of the ocean. When you remember your true identity as the ocean, consciousness, you reclaim your inherent power to create worlds. Life from the seventh level. You have glimpsed the truth of your being as pure consciousness, as the presence of the I am. But how does this sublime realization, this state that seems so ethereal, translate into the everyday experience of life? Does it mean that we stop being human, that we become indifferent, or that we float through the world in a mystical trance? Quite the opposite. Living from the seventh level does not take you out of life. it allows you for the first time to live it fully. When your center of gravity shifts from your personality, the wave, to your being, the ocean, your way of experiencing reality is radically transformed. The dissolution of problems. A problem, in its essence, is not a situation. It is a story that the mind tells about a situation, a story charged with resistance and judgment. From the perspective of the silent witness of pure consciousness, problems do not exist. Only situations exist, situations that arise and are met, not with the anxious resistance of the ego, but with the calm and wisdom of the self. The energy that was once wasted on worrying about the problem is now available to find its solution. The end of fundamental fear. The ego's deepest fear is the fear of annihilation, the fear of death. It is the terror of the wave dissolving back into the ocean. But when you have recognized that your true identity is not the wave, but the ocean itself, this fear loses its power. You understand that the form, your body, your personality, is temporary, but that the consciousness you are is eternal. This realization does not make you reckless, but it instills in you a serene courage to live more audaciously, to love more completely, to risk expressing your truth because you know that in your essence you cannot be harmed. The birth of unconditional love. The ego's love is transactional. I love you if you make me happy. It is a love that comes from lack. When you recognize yourself as the consciousness that also animates the other, love ceases to be an emotion you give or receive. It becomes your natural state. Love is revealed as the recognition of unity. You love others not for what they do, but because in their deepest essence, they are you. This is the source of true compassion. The workshop of the sage integrated practices. The initiate at the seventh level no longer practices to arrive at a state. His practice is an art of abiding in the state he has recognized as his home. His tools are subtle, designed not to build, but to remember. The central practice of the sage is the I Am meditation. He does not meditate to calm the mind, a goal that comes from conflict. He meditates to remember who he is. He sits in silence, closes his eyes, and with each inhalation he gently introduces the mental syllable I. With each exhalation, the syllable am, not I am this or I am that. Simply, I am. He allows his attention to rest in this simple, pure and naked feeling of existing, the consciousness that is present before any label, before any story. This I am is his true home, and meditation is the daily act of returning home, of wiping away the dust of forgetfulness. When, throughout the day, the old habit of identification with a thought or emotion tries to hijack his peace, the sage does not fight it. He uses the sharp sword of self-inquiry, the question popularized by the great master Ramana Maharshi. When anger arises, instead of being swept away by it, the sage asks himself inwardly, with genuine curiosity, who is aware of this anger? This question does not seek an intellectual answer. It is a koan, a tool for reorienting consciousness. It is impossible to answer it with the mind. Its only function is to divert attention from the object, the anger, to the subject, the consciousness that is aware of it. This simple act of reorientation instantly pulls him out of the cloud and returns him to the sky. It is the fastest tool for remembering. Finally, the master's practice is not a technique, but a state of being. It is the art of living as the silent witness. The initiate performs his daily tasks, participates in conversations, experiences joys and sorrows, but a part of his consciousness always remains anchored in the silent background, in the space of the I am. He lives with one foot in the world of form and the other in the world of the formless. He is the bridge between heaven and earth. He is no longer a person who seeks spiritual experiences. He has become spirituality, experiencing itself as a person. The seventh level is not a goal to be achieved. It is the truth of what you already are, waiting to be recognized. It is the end of all searching, because you have realized that you are what you have always been looking for. You have ascended through the seven floors of the building of consciousness, from the basement of the victim to the penthouse of being, only to discover that you are not the inhabitant. You are the building itself, and the infinite sky that surrounds it. you have completed the theoretical part of your initiation. You have received the complete map of the territory of consciousness. Now with this new and elevated perspective, you are ready to enter the practical workshop and learn, with renewed mastery, to use this knowledge to shape your reality in a way you never before imagined. Chapter 8, The Conscious Creator's Workshop. Now with the wisdom of the seventh level as your foundation, we descend once again from the summit of contemplation and open the doors of the workshop. It is time to move from revelation to realization, from theory to practice. Welcome to the Conscious Creator's Workshop. In the lower levels of consciousness, life is a reaction. We react to circumstances, to emotions, to the automatic thoughts that arise from our programming. In the higher levels, life becomes a creation. We stop being the effect and become the cause. This workshop and the ones that follow are your practical training to live as a conscious cause. We are no longer going to explore what the laws are, but how to apply them in an integrated and powerful way to shape the symphony of your life. The first discipline, the mastery of the inner state. The Creator's first and most fundamental work is not in the external world. It is not doing things. It is mastering his own inner state. The initiate understands that his state of being, his vibration, his emotional climate, is the mold from which the clay of reality is poured. If the inner mold is one of anxiety and scarcity, the reality that solidifies on the outside can only have that same shape. If the mold is one of peace and abundance, reality will reflect that quality. Therefore, before trying to create anything specific, the master dedicates time to becoming the engineer of his own energy, the guardian of his own state. This mastery is cultivated through three fundamental practices, centering, purification, and tuning. One, the practice of centering, the anchor of consciousness. The Creator's first act upon entering his workshop is to center himself. He knows that he cannot compose a symphony from a place of chaos. The untrained mind is a whirlwind, swept by the wind of external stimuli and internal thoughts. Centering is the act of anchoring oneself in the calm eye of the hurricane. The simplest and most profound tool to achieve this is conscious breathing. The master does not use breath simply to oxygenate his body. He uses it as a switch to change his nervous system. He knows that inhalation is linked to the sympathetic system, the fight-or-flight system, that of action. And he knows that exhalation is linked to the parasympathetic system, the rest and digest system, that of calm and receptivity. One of the most powerful practices is the physiological sigh. The initiate, to calm an agitated mind, first inhales deeply through the nose. Right at the end of the inhalation, without exhaling, he takes another small sip of air to fill the lungs to the maximum. And then he exhales slowly, long and audibly through the mouth. He repeats this two or three times. This simple mechanical act sends an unmistakable signal to the brain that the danger has passed and deactivates the stress response. Once the nervous system has calmed down, the master goes deeper. He practices the art of being the silent witness. His practice is not to empty the mind, a goal that comes from conflict. It is to observe the flow of thoughts without identifying with them. He sits in silence and allows thoughts to appear, stay and go like clouds crossing the sky. In doing this, he weakens the habit of identification. He remembers over and over again that he is not the clouds, but the sky. This practice of de-identification is the foundation of all mental freedom. The practice of purification, emotional alchemy. Once the space has been calmed, the Creator cleans his workshop. He examines the emotional climate of his being. If there are clouds of fear, resentment, or sadness, he does not ignore or repress them. He knows that repressed emotions are stagnant energy, dirty fuel that pollutes any new creation. Instead, he transmutes them. For past wounds, resentment, and guilt, the purification tool is radical forgiveness, as we have explored. The initiate performs the liberation ritual not as a moral act, but as a pragmatic, energetic cleansing. He knows that clinging to resentment is like trying to paint a picture of a sunny landscape while holding a brush full of mud. For difficult emotions that arise in the present moment, the master uses a real-time alchemy technique, often known as the RAIN protocol. Jocelyn recognizes the instant he feels a contractive emotion like anger arise, the first step is to recognize it without judgment. Mentally, he names it, "Ah, this is anger." Taisur accept, allow. The second step is the most radical. He does not fight the emotion. He gives it permission to be there. He lets go of all resistance. I investigate. With a gentle curiosity, he brings his attention to the physical sensations of the emotion. Where do I feel this anger in my body? Is it a warmth in my chest? A tension in my jaw? By investigating the physical sensation, he disassociates from the mental story that feeds it. N. Nurture. Finally, the master offers himself a dose of compassion. He places a hand on his heart and says inwardly, "This is painful. It's okay to feel this." This self-compassion is the solvent that dissolves the energy of the emotion. Through this practice, the creator ceases to be a victim of his emotions and becomes their alchemist, transforming the energy of the lead of suffering into the gold of consciousness. Through the practice of tuning, tuning into abundance. With a calmed mind and a purified heart, the last step of preparation is to tune the instrument. It is to deliberately raise one's own vibration to the frequency of creation and reception. The most powerful tool for this tuning is gratitude. The master knows that gratitude is the vibrational signature of abundance. It is the feeling of the wish already fulfilled. One of the most effective practices is the gratitude burst. The initiate sets a timer for 5 or 10 minutes, and during that time he writes in his journal, without stopping, everything he is grateful for. He does not filter or edit. He allows gratitude to flow in an uninterrupted stream. I am grateful for my breath, for the sun, for this cup of coffee, for the memory of that laughter, for the challenge that made me stronger. This exercise of total immersion floods his nervous system with the chemistry of well-being and tunes his electromagnetic field to the frequency of reception. The creator has prepared his workshop. His mind is calm. His heart is pure, his vibration is tuned. He is anchored in the power of the I Am. Now, and only now, is he ready to take the clay of potentiality and begin to sculpt. The second discipline, the art of deliberate projection. You have prepared your workshop. Your mind is calm, your heart purified, your vibration tuned. You are operating from the seventh level, from the consciousness of being, the point of stillness from which all creation is born. Now, from this place of power, we are going to learn the techniques of direction. We are going to learn to take the pure energy of consciousness and give it a specific shape and direction, to project it into the mirror of the world so that it manifests. This is the heart of conscious creation, and it is based on two great arts, the art of the decree and the art of visualization. Forging the Keys, the Decree Workshop. The first act of projection is through the word, the verb. The conscious creator knows that his words are spells, decrees that structure energy, and give a clear command to the subconscious. The initiate does not recite generic phrases he has read in a book. He forges his decrees in the fire of his own soul. His practice is a process of refinement. He takes his journal and first identifies with absolute clarity the quality of being he chooses to embody. For example, confidence. Then he translates that quality into a powerful decree in the present tense, using the most potent formula of all, the I Am. He does not write, "I want to be more confident." He writes, "I am the embodiment of serene and unshakable confidence." The master understands that a decree is not just a phrase, but an identity. And to install that identity, he uses the most intimate ritual, mirror work. He stands in front of his own reflection, but he does not see a mask. He looks deeply into his own eyes, into the windows of his soul. And from that place of connection, he pronounces his decree aloud. He does not do it to convince himself, but to remind himself who he has chosen to be. He feels the vibration of the words in his chest, in his throat, and he observes the reaction of his inner critic, the voice of doubt, but he no longer identifies with it. He simply observes it as the echo of an old program, and with a sovereign calm, he again declares his new truth. I am confidence. This practice, repeated day after day, is an act of deliberate neuroplasticity. It is the act of carving with the chisel of the word a new neural groove, a new identity. Building the hologram, the visualization workshop. If the decree is the score, visualization is the symphony itself. It is the native language of the subconscious. It is the tool for creating memories of the future that program your brain and body for a new reality. The conscious creator is a film director of his inner world, and his method is precise. He knows that he should not visualize the struggle, the process. He travels in time. He sits in the stillness of his workshop and transports himself to the moment after his wish has been fulfilled. He chooses a short scene, a final frame that implies success. Then he immerses himself in that scene, not as a spectator but as the protagonist. He looks through his own eyes. If his desire is a new house, he does not see an image of the house. He feels the cold key in his hand. He hears the sound of the door opening. He smells the new paint. He sees the light entering through the window of his new living room. It is a multi-sensory immersion. And most importantly, he bathes in the emotion of the scene. He feels the relief. He feels the gratitude. He feels the joy. He feels the deep peace of being home. This emotion is the signal that tells his nervous system, "This is real. Record it." He repeats this short movie, this hologram of the fulfilled reality over and over, especially in the portal of sleep, until the feeling becomes so familiar, so natural, that he falls asleep in his new home. The Symphony of Practice. The initiate understands that these practices are not isolated tasks. They are the instruments of his orchestra, and he learns to combine them in a daily symphony. His morning practice could be a ritual of tuning and composition. He begins with silence, with listening to his intuition. Chapter 5. From that listening, he chooses his intention for the day. Chapter 4. Then he formulates his I Am decree and declares it in the mirror. Chapter 8. And finally, he dedicates a few minutes to visualizing his day, unfolding in perfect harmony with that intention, feeling the emotion of success. Chapter 9. He has dedicated 15 minutes, and he has done the most important work of his day. He has established the cause. The rest of the day becomes the unfolding of the effect. The conscious creator's workshop is not a physical place. It is a state of being. It is the daily and deliberate practice of aligning your inner world, your thoughts, your beliefs, your emotions, so that your outer world has no choice but to reflect your mastery. Chapter 9. The Lighthouse Effect. The moment you turn on your inner light, the instant you raise your own frequency, you stop being an island. You become, whether you know it or not, a lighthouse. Your being becomes a signal, a silent but immensely powerful influence in the fabric of reality. Welcome to the ninth level, which is really the external manifestation of the seventh, the consciousness of the lighthouse effect, the domino effect of consciousness. In the lower levels, we live under the illusion of separation. We believe that our consciousness, our thoughts, and our emotions are contained within our skull. But metaphysics and quantum physics reveal a deeper truth. We live in a unified and interconnected field of consciousness. We are not separate. We are waves in the same ocean. This means that our inner state is not a private matter. Every thought we have, every emotion we feel, every vibration we emit is like a stone thrown into a pond. It creates ripples that expand and influence the entire pond. Your state of being is, at this very instant, subtly affecting the people, places, and situations around you. Science has begun to measure this phenomenon. Studies like the Maharishi effect at one point suggested that large groups of people meditating could reduce crime rates in a city. The HeartMath Institute has shown that the coherent electromagnetic field of a heart in a state of gratitude can be measured several meters away and can positively influence another person's nervous system. What mystics have known for centuries, science is beginning to confirm. Your consciousness has a tangible effect on the world. The initiate at this level of consciousness no longer asks, "How can I change the world?" He realizes that he is changing the world every instant with the quality of his own presence. And this bestows upon him a new and sacred responsibility. The lighthouse versus the tugboat. Two forms of influence. When we awaken to our power, our first impulse, often born of the ego, is to try to help others. We see our loved ones trapped in the lower levels of consciousness, in victimhood, in struggle, and we want to rescue them. We become what we could call a tugboat. The tugboat is the person who, with the best intentions, tries to force the awakening of others. He tells them what they are doing wrong. He gives them unsolicited advice. He tries to convince them with logical arguments. He gets frustrated when they don't follow his wise advice. He tries, in essence, to get on their boat, grab the oars, and row for them toward the shore of enlightenment. This strategy, although well-intentioned, is born of the ego. It comes from the belief of I know better than you, and a subtle need to control the other's journey. And almost always it produces the opposite effect. It generates resistance. The other person feels judged, invalidated, and clings more tightly to their old beliefs. And the tugboat, in the process, drains his own energy in a useless struggle. The master who has reached the ninth level understands that this is not the way. He abandons the exhausting work of the tugboat and adopts the serene and powerful posture of the lighthouse. Think of a lighthouse. The lighthouse does not chase lost ships in the storm. It does not shout instructions at them through a loudspeaker. It does not judge the captain who has lost his way. The lighthouse has only one job, a single sacred function, to be light. It anchors itself with unshakable force to its rocky foundation, its connection to being. It diligently tends to its own inner flame, its practice of consciousness, and then it simply radiates its light constantly, unconditionally and silently in all directions. It doesn't care which ships use its light. It is not offended if a ship chooses to ignore it and crash against the rocks. Its function is not to save, but to serve as a point of reference. By being a stable and brilliant source of light in the midst of darkness, it gives navigators the information they need to find their own way home. Influence without forcing. Guide without controlling. Serve through being, not doing. This is the lighthouse effect. The three radiations of the lighthouse: peace, clarity, and possibility. When you become a lighthouse, your consciousness begins to radiate three fundamental qualities that silently influence your environment. 1. The radiation of peace. A person who has cultivated a deep inner peace, who has calmed the civil war of their own mind, becomes a field anchor for calm. Their coherent and stable nervous system emits a frequency that the nervous systems of the people around them can feel on an unconscious level. Being in the presence of such a person is often a healing experience. Without them saying a single word, you feel more relaxed. Your own mind seems to quiet down. Their silent peace is a permission for others to find their own. They don't give you their peace. They remind you of the peace that already resides in you. 2. The radiation of clarity. A person who lives from a place of clear purpose, who has transcended the confusion of the ego, radiates an energy of focus and coherence. This clarity is like a tuning fork. When you are near it, the scattered and chaotic energy of your own mind begins to organize itself. Their focused presence helps you see your own problems more clearly. Often after a simple conversation with such a person, you leave with the solution to a problem that has been tormenting you for months, not because they gave you the answer, but because their clarity helped you find your own. 3. The radiation of possibility. Perhaps the most powerful radiation of all is that of possibility. By embodying your own potential, by living a life that transcends the limitations that most people accept as normal, you become a living proof of what is possible. You don't have to preach, you don't have to convince anyone. Your life itself is the sermon. Your joy, your freedom, your prosperity, your peace are the irrefutable evidence that demonstrates to the victim and struggle consciousness that there is another way. You are the crack in the wall of their prison, the ray of light that shows them that escape is possible. You inspire not with your words but with your example. These three radiations, peace, clarity, and possibility, are the silent service of the lighthouse. It is the highest form of contribution to the world. The workshop of the lighthouse, practices of silent influence. Becoming a lighthouse is not a passive act. It requires conscious practice and inner discipline. The initiate at the ninth level understands that his main responsibility is the maintenance of his own light. His workshop is no longer just for his own benefit. It is a service to the world. The first practice, the unshakable anchor. A lighthouse cannot guide anyone if it is swept away by the first storm. Its power lies in its stability, in its unshakable connection to the rock. For the conscious creator, this rock is his connection to being, to the consciousness of the seventh level. The practice is the cultivation of depth, not height. The initiate knows that the quality of the light he emits is directly proportional to the depth of his own inner silence. Therefore, his practice of meditation and contemplation ceases to be a tool to feel better and becomes his most important work. The ritual of silence. The master dedicates time each day in a non-negotiable way to sit in silence, not to ask, not to visualize, but simply to be, to rest in pure consciousness in the I am. This is the act of recharging his light at the source of all light. Anchoring in the body. Throughout the day, the initiate constantly practices returning to his body. He feels his breath. He feels his feet on the ground. He knows that the body is the anchor that keeps him present and connected to his rock, preventing his mind from being swept away by the winds of collective drama. The second practice, unconditional transmission. The lighthouse does not choose which ships to illuminate. It does not deny its light to the pirate ship or offer it more intensely to the king's ship. Its light is unconditional. The practice for the initiate is that of impersonal love. It is the art of radiating an energy of peace and goodwill toward all people, without exception, regardless of whether we like them or whether they deserve our light. The lighthouse meditation. One of the most powerful practices is this visualization. The initiate sits in silence and visualizes himself as a lighthouse on a dark night. In his heart, he lights a bright flame of peace and love. And then, with his intention, he turns that light, sending a beam of well-being in 360 degrees. He sends light to his loved ones, to his community, to people with whom he has conflicts, to the leaders of the world, to all beings who suffer. He does not try to fix anyone. He simply offers his light. This act pulls him out of the small agenda of his ego and aligns him with the compassionate purpose of his soul. The third practice, the responsibility of resonance. The master understands that he is responsible for the music he plays in the orchestra of collective consciousness, and he practices impeccable vibrational hygiene. The conscious filter. He becomes extremely selective with the information he consumes. He avoids immersing himself in the energy of fear and outrage that the media and social networks promote, not out of ignorance, but out of wisdom. He knows that he cannot be a lighthouse of peace if he is constantly feeding his flame with the fuel of conflict, the conscious contribution. In the same way, he becomes aware of the energy he emits. In his conversations and interactions, he asks himself, "Am I adding noise to the world, or am I providing harmony? Am I emitting a frequency of complaint or one of possibility?" His goal is for each of his interactions
Oshinimo mtumba go Namibia International Cyber Security Conference and Exhibition onvoma ovigajo mirongo balina khamano ikondo epangero mahangano go paumwene u ministeri wepangero ni ikondo ya yoroka no handimwe oneta muisanwa muhoroke komtumba omti tatu watumburwa metetekero esikwa mirongo balinaga lisiko balinaga nega apiriri mwavigalyo mirongo balina khamano ekharoko Arembush Travel Lodge movenduka oshiparashi kundathanwa okwanja gane kuyerere kombinga uko shoki wopaungomba ano cyber hygiene kene una okuyironge kidira omashongo ko marungura no marongo ke popepe ko jerongizo jo marungura na irwenji koneka omahangano ohandimwe ni ikondo mboka tamkatuma akaliripo yakonda pantu ya tano Otamukape wa ombito yom tugumwe awedwa pon hasho ashikeshoka pethimbo yom tumba gotungoka otakukakara o VIP cyber gala dina nuyere ronji wa maisha ngiso no mapura puro kwatasana nayo konraje tatu imwe onda tu yatano omgoigeal nenge ko email info@dstech.com.na nenge utarere pwe panja jao jopa ngomba ko www.dstech.com.na Namibia International No Cyber Security Conference and Exhibition, Securing Namibia Digital Future.
Leave the collective energy field a little more coherent and a little more luminous than he found it. The awakening of the other, the side effect of your own light. When you live this way, as an anchored and radiant lighthouse, a miraculous phenomenon occurs. The people around you begin to change. Not because you tried to change them, but because your own transformation creates a new field of resonance. Your calm invites the calm of others. Your non-judgment creates a safe space for others to be authentic. Your confidence in abundance can silently begin to dissolve the scarcity consciousness of your family. You don't have to do anything. Simply be the light. And those who are ready to awaken will be drawn to your flame, not as followers, but as other lighthouses who, upon seeing your light, remember how to turn on their own. This is true service. It is not creating dependence, but inspiring sovereignty. The lighthouse effect is the culmination of the inward journey. It is the moment when your personal healing becomes a blessing to the world. It is the discovery that the most powerful way to change the world is not by fighting its darkness, but by adding, with a silent and persistent dedication, your own irreplaceable light. Chapter 10. Living at the Peak of Consciousness. The journey through the seven levels is not a ladder you climb and then discard the lower rungs. It is a process of integration, like a symphony that builds layer upon layer of complexity and beauty. The person who has reached the peak has not eliminated the warrior or the achiever he once was. He has integrated their wisdom and transmuted their energy. To live at the peak of consciousness is to live as a complete human being. You have the responsibility of the first level, that of the awakened victim, knowing that you are the cause of your reality. You have the discipline of the second level, that of the warrior. But now you use it not to fight the world, but to master yourself. You have the strategy of the third level, that of the achiever, but your goals are no longer born of the ego, but of the soul. You have the clarity of the fourth level, that of intention, knowing that your what and your why are the compass of your life. You have the confidence of the fifth level, that of flow, dancing with the universe instead of resisting it. You have the compassion of the sixth level, that of unity, recognizing yourself in the face of all things. And all of this is anchored in the peace of the seventh level, that of being, the silent certainty of who you are beyond all form and all story. Living from this place is not a mystical experience removed from the world. On the contrary, it is the most practical, most effective, and most joyful way to live a human life. This state of mastery is manifested through three jewels, three fundamental qualities that permeate every aspect of your existence. The first jewel, effortless action, Wu Wei. The first and most visible of the transformations is your relationship with action. Life for the lower levels is a struggle. It is a constant pushing, forcing, resisting. It is the energy of effort. From the peak of consciousness, you discover the Taoist principle of Wu Wei, which translates as effortless action or active non-action. This does not mean laziness or passivity. In fact, you often achieve much more. It means that your actions no longer arise from your ego's anxious planning, but emerge, spontaneously and perfectly appropriate, from the intelligence of the present moment. You stop being the rower who struggles against the current, and you become the current itself. In a conversation, you stop planning your next sentence and instead you listen so deeply that the perfect response simply arises from within you. In your work, you stop forcing creativity and instead you create a space of calm and play that allows inspiration to flow through you. In a crisis, you stop reacting with panic and instead you become still, waiting for the intuitive impulse that will show you the path of least resistance. Effortless action is the perfectly balanced dance between the masculine and feminine principles of creation. You know when to apply focused intention and decisive action, masculine energy, and you know when to surrender, wait, and receive guidance, feminine energy. Your life stops being a series of problems to be solved and becomes a creative flow in which you participate with a grace that to others may seem miraculous. To you, it is simply natural. The second jewel, unconditional peace, the immovable foundation. The second jewel is the quality of your inner peace. In the lower levels, peace is a conditional good. It is a fleeting visitor that only appears when external circumstances are favorable. We feel peace if we have enough money, if our relationships are harmonious, if our health is good. It is a fragile peace, always at the mercy of the next challenge. From the peak of consciousness, you discover a peace of a completely different nature. It is an unconditional peace. It is the peace that the sacred text calls the peace that surpasses all understanding. This peace is not born from the absence of problems. It is born from the de-identification with problems. You have practiced being the silent witness for so long that it has become your default state. You experience thoughts, but you know you are not your thoughts. You experience emotions, but you know you are not your emotions. You experience the ups and downs of life, but you know you are not the ups and downs. You are the immutable consciousness, the serene sky in which the clouds of the world and the mind appear and disappear. And because your identity is anchored in the sky, no storm on the surface can disturb your deep calm. This unshakable peace is what allows you to live with a completely open heart. You are no longer afraid of emotional pain because you know that pain cannot harm your true self. This frees you to love with a vulnerability and depth that were previously impossible. It allows you to be present with the suffering of others without being swept away by it, turning you into a true lighthouse of compassion. It allows you to face life's greatest challenges, not from a place of contraction and fear, but from a center of calm and expansive power. The third jewel, the game with purpose, Lila. The third and most joyful of the jewels is the transformation of your perspective on life itself. For the ego, life is a very serious matter. It is a problem to be solved, a test to be passed, a battle to be won. From the peak of consciousness, you realize the truth that the sages of India called Lila, the divine play. You understand that universal consciousness did not create the universe out of a serious and grave necessity, but out of the pure joy of self-expression, out of the joy of the creative dance. And in realizing this, your own life ceases to be a solemn drama and becomes a sacred game. This does not mean you become frivolous or irresponsible. On the contrary, you become the best of players. You commit fully to your roles, that of a parent, a professional, a friend, and you play them with total excellence and presence. But internally, you maintain a lightness, a playful detachment. You know it's a game. When the game presents you with a victory, you celebrate it with genuine joy, but you do not cling to it. When it presents you with a defeat, you feel the emotion of loss, but you do not suffer, because you know it is just a move on the great board. This perspective frees you from the greatest weight of all, the tyranny of personal importance. It gives you the freedom to be audacious, to be creative, to experiment, to fail with a smile, and to try again. The fear of doing it wrong disappears, because you understand that as long as you play with an open heart and an intention of growth, there are no wrong moves. Everything is part of the dance. Life becomes your work of art. Your purpose is no longer to get somewhere, but to paint the canvas of each day with the most vibrant and authentic colors of your own being. Work becomes play, relationships become a dance, and existence itself becomes a celebration. The workshop of the integrated self, the practice of non-practice. Reaching the peak of consciousness does not mean that the work is over. It means that the work becomes infinitely more subtle. The initiate at the seventh level no longer clings to techniques like a castaway to a plank. The techniques were the scaffolding needed to build the building of his new consciousness. Once the building is finished and solid, the scaffolding can be removed. The practice is no longer something he does for 15 minutes in the morning. It becomes the very quality of his presence throughout the entire day. It is a non-practice, a state of being that is sustained by three pillars of embodiment. The first pillar, anchored presence. The foundation of a masterful life is presence. The master has trained his attention to the point that he can maintain a double focus consciousness. One part of his attention is engaged with the task at hand, with the conversation he is having, with the world of form. But another part of his attention always remains anchored in the silent background of his own being, in the feeling of the I am. It is like a master musician who, while playing an incredibly complex melody, is always aware of the tonic note, the harmonic center that holds the whole piece together. This constant connection to inner silence is what allows him to move through the world of noise without being swept away by it. The initiate's integrated practice is constant anchoring. In the middle of a business meeting, he feels the energy in the room, but he also feels the calm in his own chest. As he walks through a bustling city, he observes the external chaos, but he is also aware of the silent space of his own presence. In a difficult conversation, he listens to the other's words, but he also listens to the silence beneath them. This double focus is the anchor that keeps him at the pendulum's point of suspension, allowing him to experience life fully without getting lost in it. The second pillar, intuitive alignment. The master no longer makes decisions based solely on the ego's logic or on lists of pros and cons. He has learned to trust a higher form of intelligence. His decision-making process is based on alignment. The practice is the alignment question. Faced with any choice, from the smallest to the most momentous, the master does not ask himself, "What is best for me?" He asks himself, "What choice feels most aligned with the being that I know I am? What path resonates with greater expansion, with greater truth, with greater love?" Sometimes the alignment answer will seem completely illogical to the rational mind. It may ask him to leave a secure but soulless job, or to initiate a vulnerable conversation that his ego fears. But the master has learned, through experience, that the path of alignment, though sometimes the most difficult in the short term, is always the path of least resistance in the long term. It is the path that the river of life wants to take through him, and he has learned to trust that current. The third pillar, service as an overflow. Finally, the person who lives at the peak of consciousness discovers the true purpose of power, service. But this is not the forced service of the ego's should. It is the natural overflow of his own wholeness. The initiate has spent so much time cultivating his inner garden, nurturing his peace, his love, and his wisdom, that his cup inevitably begins to overflow. And this overflow is his service to the world. The practice is not to ask, "How can I help?" It is to ask, "How can I be the fullest and most authentic expression of myself?" For the artist, service is creating the most beautiful and honest work he can, knowing that its beauty will elevate the consciousness of those who contemplate it. For the entrepreneur, service is building a business that is not only profitable, but that solves a real problem, that treats its employees with dignity, and that operates ethically. For the parent, service is offering their children a presence of unconditional love and calm, creating the environment for another soul to flourish. For the friend, service is simply listening, offering the space of their non-judgmental presence so that the other can find themselves. The master knows that the form of his service is irrelevant. The only thing that matters is the source from which it emanates, a heart so full that it cannot help but give. Living at the peak of consciousness is not reaching a static state of human perfection. It is the beginning of a life lived as art. It is the endless dance between being and doing, between the silence of the mountain and the music of the marketplace. In the level of intention, we turned our gaze inward. We learned to surrender to the current in the level of flow. We dissolved the illusion of separation in the vast peace of unity. And finally, we returned home to the silence of being on the seventh level. But the final revelation, the truly forbidden knowledge, is this. The goal was never to reach the top floor. The secret is that all the levels of consciousness exist within us right now. Mastery is not about living permanently in the penthouse, but about learning to visit any floor at will, consciously choosing the level from which to operate at any given moment. It is about knowing when to use the warrior's discipline, the achiever's strategy, and the mystic's surrender. It is about integrating all parts of our being into a harmonious whole. Your journey does not end with the end of these words. Because the journey is the destination, your practice from today on is simple. In every moment of choice, in every challenge, ask yourself the master's question. From what level of consciousness do I choose to respond to this? Don't look for the end of the road. Fall in love with the road. Because the expansion of consciousness is the infinite game that the universe plays with itself. And you are the player. Brief pause in the narration. The background music remains very soft. If this map of consciousness has resonated with you and has illuminated your own path, we invite you to continue this ascension. Subscribe to our channel, Path of Knowledge, for more.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so we've been talking about breaking free, yeah, of our minds and not being held prisoners and captive by our minds. Now, part of these core strategy values for mental freedom, right, is practicing mindfulness. Become aware of negative thoughts as they arise, observing them without judgment rather than becoming entangled in them. Number two, recognize you are not your thoughts, right? Separate your sense of self from automated and automations of dysfunctional thoughts, all right? And number three, ground yourself in the present. Ground yourself in the present. Focus on current physical sentences. Ground yourself. Focus on current physical sensations to break the cycle of rumination on the past or the future. Ground yourself here. Take off your shoes. Put your feet down. Wiggle your toes. Wiggle your fingertips. And number four, use a third person perspective. Now, this one's a tough one, especially when we are dealing with ourselves, because we are our biggest enemy. We are our biggest downfall, but we are also our biggest cheerleaders. It's a wacky relationship, but use third person perspective. View your thoughts and feelings from an outside perspective to reduce their emotional intensity. And number five, engage in disruptive action. Engage in it. And then you're thinking disruptive? Yeah, disruptive actions. Because you're supposed to distract yourself, right? From that you are thinking. Those negative thoughts, those negative self-talk, those bad things. Shift your mental state by changing activities, engaging in physical exercise, or connecting with nature. Techniques to release negative thinking. So it's all about the mind, right? One, self-compassion. And we spoke about it. The book also spoke about it, right? Treat yourself like someone you love. Treat yourself with kindness, acknowledging that changing ingrained thought patterns can take time. You can't just change overnight, and be patient with yourself. Number two is challenge assumptions. Question whether your negative thoughts are absolute truths or merely limited perspectives. Limited. All right, and number three, reduce digital consumption. I think that one of the biggest issues that we have in the 21st century is digits. It is internet and devices. I think that is one of our biggest challenges and our biggest flaws, because the way we are addicted to them, without even knowing that we are addicted to them. For example, I know that I'm addicted to my banking app. I visit the banking app at least 10 times. At least, and that's on the bare minimum, at least 10 times a day. And whether I have dinero or I don't have dinero, I'm going to check. right? I just want to make sure it's still zero. I just want to make sure. I just want to see. I just want to check. It's like children with the fridge. They know exactly what's in the fridge, but they go and check anyways. The way they open that fridge 10 times, chwa, 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 chwa. You're like, how is the cake that you're magically expecting to come about going to magically appear in the fridge, or who's it? And minimize time on phones, social media to prevent constant stressful distractions. Because if you just distract yourself from being distracted, you can at least get something done. So, go back to the pen and the paper. Go back to the books. Go back to the listening. Go back. You'll see that your life might change drastically, because you'll be less stressed about who is wearing what. And it's not to say that all of us are going onto social media to idolize others or to compare ourselves. It just pops up a lot. Like for me, for example, I'm a food person. So I go onto the internet to watch people cook and sometimes to watch them eat. And what else do I do? That's it. Also, and psychological videos, like psychological knowledge and stuff. And I like that. But what I've also noticed is that I can spend hours on end on the internet. And this needs to stop, because my consumption, it's not something that I'm proud of. It's not something that I want. All right? So I'm reducing digital consumption. And next dot is number 4. Cultivate a gratitude. Actively focus on positive aspects of life to concentrate and to default negative thoughts and situations and cases. Like the worst case scenario mindset will come to an end. The next one is use therapeutic tools. Utilize journaling to process your thoughts, or seek professional support to address deep-seated mental illusions. Because I think that we as human beings find it very difficult for us to think that we could actually be wrong. To think that our minds could Jedi us. But it all starts in the mind.
Lipurane ngelo wapubwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe udite opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi tayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijabo ili nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu watatu omafilane Eagle FM. The eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
From childhood's hour, I have not been as others were. I have not seen as others saw. I could not bring my passions from a common spring. From the same source, I have not taken my sorrow. I could not awaken my heart to joy at the same tone. And all I loved alone. Then in my childhood, in the dawn of a most stormy life, was drawn from every depth of good and ill, the mystery which binds me still. From the torrent of the fountain, from the red cliff of the mountain, from the sun that round me rolled in its autumn tint of gold, from the lightning in the sky as it passed me flying by, from the thunder and the storm and the cloud that took the form, when the rest of heaven was blue, of a demon in my view.
Go placidly amid the noise and the haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your truth quietly and clearly, and listen to others. Even to the dull and the ignorant, they too have their story. Avoid loud and aggressive persons. They are vexations to the spirit. If you compare yourself with others, you may become vain or bitter. For always there will be greater and lesser persons than yourself. Enjoy your achievements as well as your plans. Keep interested in your own career, however humble. It is a real possession in the changing fortunes of time. Exercise caution in your business affairs, for the world is full of trickery. But let this not blind you to what virtue there is. Many persons strive for high ideals, and everywhere life is full of heroism. Be yourself, especially do not feign affection. Neither be cynical about love, for in the face of all aridity and disenchantment, it is as perennial as the grass.
It is perennial as the grass. All right, ladies and gentlemen, with that said, I bid you guys farewell. I love you forever and a day. You are important to me, and I'll see you on the other side.